It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott, Richard Campbell are here. It's finally, almost nearly, practically official. Microsoft will acquire Activision. I'll tell you what is official. Our last segment on this topic for some time. We'll also talk about AI. Microsoft has announced pricing for Microsoft 365 Copilot. You better be sitting down for that one. Plus, an Xbox game that offers 1,300 classic arcade games all in one. That and a whole lot more coming up next on Windows Weekly. This show is brought to you by Cisco Meraki. Without a cloud-managed network, businesses inevitably fall behind. Experience the ease and efficiency of Meraki's single platform to elevate the place where your employees and customers come together. Cisco Meraki maximizes uptime and minimizes loss to digitally transform your organization. Meraki's intuitive interface, increased connectivity, and multi-site management keep your organization operating seamlessly and securely wherever you're team is. Let Cisco Meraki's 24/7 available support help your organization's remote, on-site, and hybrid teams always do their best work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell, episode 838, recorded Wednesday, July 19th, 2023. Dabbling with Farkless. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by Cisco Meraki. With employees working in different locations, providing a unified work experience seems as easy as herding cats. How do you rein in so many moving parts? The Meraki Cloud Managed Network. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. And by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution for companies with Okta, and they ensure that if a device isn't trusted and secure, it can't log into your cloud apps. Visit KOLIDE.com/WW. to book an on-demand demo today. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news for Microsoft. And here you are, ladies and gentlemen, today's contestants coming onto the stage. It's Richard Campbell from Runners Radio.
Hello, hello.
And Paul Thurrott, podcaster and blogger. Thurrott.com. And he's in Mexico. You're in Coquitlam.
Yep. Still.
All is well.
A little bit longer.
Okay. Hello,
thanks
gents.
To Wink Martindale.
Johnny Gilbert, 97 years old, the announcer for Jeopardy. He does it from his house now. Nice. But he's 97 and he's still going strong. Man. And that's my dream. Work a total of 45 days a year and make millions of dollars. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's a good, it's the sweet spot.
It is.
It's a game.
Yeah, I hope people, you know, in that position know how lucky they are. But then there's people like Jim Cutler, who's one of the great announcers of all time, did our all of our VOs and stuff, who works like a dog. And he's got a studio in his house, so there's no excuse.
Yeah, but you know what? If that's what he wants,
I guess.
That's fine, right?
Sometimes you stumble into these things, and then you can't
get out. I would point out that Henry Kissinger, at 100 years old, meeting with the Chinese ambassador.
Still a war criminal.
Still screwing up international relations.
Unbelievable. 100 years old.
Listen, still a war criminal at 100 years old. Yep. We shouldn't laugh. I'm going to see Oppenheimer in a couple of weeks. It just opened, of course. And
nice. Hopefully on IMAX.
Yeah, I'm going to see the 70mm IMAX, which is funny because when you make the reservation, you know, you're looking at the seats and it's like the hollow core of my life. It's all hollowed out in the middle there. Yeah. All you can do is sit on the edges. So I just kept looking until I could find one where I was kind of in the middle. Not the middle of the middle, but high middle.
It's going to be like a tennis match. Like your head's going to be going back and forth like this the whole time.
I have sat close to the front in IMAX, and that is not a good place to sit.
Right.
The ideal, I guess,
it's a lot of screen,
a little ways back, but you really want to be in the middle for some reason. I'm not sure why. Anyway, yeah, you don't want your crick in your neck. It is a 3-hour movie.
Yeah. It seems to be the thing these days. If you're going to go to the movies, you're going to go to movies for a long time.
It's going to be a big movie.
I'm very excited. I was reading a a blog. There's a Substack by a guy who is an expert on Oppenheimer, who's kind of commenting on the historicity of it. And he says it's pretty good, pretty accurate. There are a few things they maybe underplay that maybe should be overplayed, like why did we do it? And really, was Nagasaki necessary? But, you know, other than that,
they needed to test the implosion device.
I'm tired of all you Monday morning quarterbacks. Okay?
That's a little late for that, I guess. It is. The anniversary of Trinity? It must be the 60th, 70th, 80th anniversary of Trinity. It's the 80th anniversary of Trinity today or this week.
It will be, yeah. All right. Trinity. I'm sorry.
Trinity was where the first explosion of the atomic
first
bomb.
Explosion, right. See, I was thinking at the end of the war. Yeah. So 2 years will be the end of the war.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let me see.
That was 78 years ago.
Yeah, 78. Thank you for the math. anyway, we're here not to talk about anything of that, you know, ilk at all. July 16th, so it was a couple of days ago.
That was the day that Apollo 11 took off in
July 16th. Yeah, 1969. Yeah.
Also the day I was born.
Oh, well, you would know then, but not in 1945.
Not so much. No.
Not unless he's discovered some secret we're going to need to hear about.
You're not. What is it? 80. What did you say? 80, 85, 83,
78.
Wait, 78.
When you say remember the Civil War, what are you referring to exactly?
Hey, the big news is in. Everybody has
so exciting.
The table has been cleared. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, as expected, upheld the judge's decision. Said there's no reason for an injunction on this.
You're jumping way ahead.
Okay.
I am.
Give us the timeline.
You guys, better than anyone, know I've spent most of this year figuring out the roller coaster that is how updates to Windows 11 have changed, right? back and forth. I never thought anything would ever be stupider, longer, more drawn out. And once again, I've been proven wrong. This Microsoft Activision Blizzard merger, acquisition, whatever, has been even more topsy-turvy. Last week was insane.
Yes.
Since we convened, it has been even more insane. So, yes, when we left things last week, there were two caveats, remember? One was that the FTC might file an appeal to the verdict. Right. They did. They were roundly slapped in the face and denied that.
Summarily declined.
Yeah. I'm paraphrasing the ruling. It said no. Basically, it was very short. So that was interesting. That's right. Oh, and I should say, just because I have to write about this, right? Mm-hmm. Once the FTC lost its appeal, there was a very strong chance, I thought, that Microsoft might actually consummate this acquisition over the weekend.
Right.
Problem is, we're in Mexico. We had friends with us, and we had already booked a hot air balloon ride for Saturday morning. I brought a laptop, and if needs be, I would have written a story.
Filed
from a balloon.
From the gondola. 3,000 feet above Mexico City.
The Aztec pyramids outside of Mexico City. that's not what happened. But
too bad, because that's a great dateline, I have to say.
Great story.
Right. So don't my dedication.
The reason we thought it would happen is that there was a breakup fee on the 18th, right? They would owe a billion if it didn't happen by the 18th.
$3 billion. Yeah. So... Yes, we got the July 18th date coming up, which is the break, the end of the deadline, which was yesterday as we record this. But we also have the UK CMA, which has been like, just kidding, and then backstep, and then just kidding, and they kind of keep going back and forth. So on the weekend, it's funny because I can't actually do this, but the UK CMA came out and said, you know what? We got a list of concessions from Microsoft that is meaningful. We are going to extend our deadline for our review of this new concessions. I'm not a UK, lawyer, legal expert, whatever, but the CMA typically issues what's called a final decision and then never comes back to readdress it ever again. This is one of the very rare times they've ever agreed to do that.
It really feels so like it's like if we can just find some way to save face. So that we can say, oh, see, we got a concession, moving on. Because they know it's over, right?
Using what will be only considered a butchered New Zealand accent, I will say backflipper or flip flopper.
You're a flip flopper. Order.
So, yes. So I think it was Sunday morning. So the balloon ride happened. We had this UK story. Okay. The acquisition was not happening.
You're up in a balloon floating above.
Checking my phone.
And you're just constantly like, let's see if did it happen.
I was thinking. And you know what? This is what bugs me. And I didn't figure this out till Monday. I had exchanged some emails with Microsoft PR on Friday night because they issued a statement about the FTC losing the appeal. And I don't know this guy. It's just a guy from Microsoft PR. And I don't typically do this. You know, so when people write me from a PR company, I always acknowledge the mail and I'll just write back and say thanks. And I had one guy or woman some years ago who said, you know, you're one of the few people that actually ever does this, you know, and I'm like, okay, I wasn't sure if it was annoying or not. But anyway, I wrote this guy back and I said, thanks. And then I said, and congratulations, which is it's just so out of character for me. And then he said, thank you. He goes, I'm so happy that I can now enjoy my weekend, which should have been the clue. This wasn't happening during the weekend, right? Didn't realize it till Monday.
He knew he was good. Yeah.
Yep. He knew he was good.
And he was trying to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Hint, hint.
So I feel bad about that. Anyway, so Sunday, we got what I think is the clearest signal yet that Microsoft is acquiring Activision Blizzard, which is that Sony, which apparently never answered a single email from Microsoft in 18 months, suddenly agreed to a deal for Call of Duty.
Yeah, I was looking at the backstory of this. Microsoft had proposed this in 2021, it said.
Yes,
right?
Yes, a long time ago.
In January.
18 months ago.
Yeah. What?
Yep. And Sony was like, yeah, we're not even looking at it, you know?
See, so, you dust off a 30-month-old email and say, okay.
Yeah. Yep. It was signed and everything, and Sony just sat on it, hoping against hope that the courts would pay no attention to it. Well, pay no attention to that email sitting in my inbox.
I now hate Sony with a burning fire that I can barely describe. But I will give them a little bit of credit because the FTC fell for their baloney rationale, like hook, line, and sinker, and continued that fight after Sony, in legal filings, admitted we never actually cared about this. We never thought that they were going to take it away.
I'm going to defend Lena Khan. Maybe she wasn't doing this at the behest of Sony. That's all that proves, that she had her own reasons.
I'm sorry. I want to be clear. I don't actually believe that the FTC was literally working on behalf of Sony.
They weren't carrying water for Sony.
No. I don't believe that. But they were, in fact, acting on behalf of Sony.
Would have benefited Sony, no question. Yes. But they had their own concerns. And they still do, apparently. They appealed it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do and they don't. I mean, their concerns 100% matched up with Sony's concerns. So even after Sony was like, I was just kidding. You know, the FTC kind of kept it going. I don't remember the judge.
That's what proves the point is, you know, if they really were just carrying water for Sony, Sony would have said, you can call off the dogs now. And that would have been that.
All right. So once again, I'm going to have to paraphrase. I don't have this quote in front of me, but when the judge originally ruled against the FTC, there was a beautiful quote, which she said something, again, I'm paraphrasing. You know, you've spent 18 months gathering evidence. You've collected 100 documents of evidence. You've gotten all these experts to rule in. You've interviewed people, and we have found not one item that backs your claim that Microsoft will .. So yeah, I mean, I guess so, but the very nature of the fear of Microsoft taking Call of Duty away from Sony and PlayStation, whatever, was completely unwarranted from day one, and that never changed.
Well, and Sony knew it, and even talked about it, and it was revealed, and the FTC continued.
That's my point. So, literally, they were not working on behalf of Sony. But at some point, when you realize that every argument you've ever made is false, made up, or just baseless, when do you give up?
You had a stack of outs.
Yep.
Right. Like at any point along any of these reveals, you could have said, hey, under the circumstances, we withdraw our case.
So I put in the awkward position of defending something that I think is defenseless. I will just say on behalf of the FTC, they have been given a political mandate to come down hard on big tech. There was further news about that today.
Right.
With regard to mergers and acquisitions. And listen, it's not a horrible defense, honestly, in this day and age to say, I'm sorry, but this company is just too freaking big. No. You know, and the powerful don't get more powerful, right? That seems to be the real point of the argument, even though
when not that they made the details, that well at all.
No, but again, I the thing is with antitrust, with everything, right? You have to look at every individual case, and this one never made sense. So, okay. Anyway, let's move on. That was Sunday. So in order for the CMA extension, the deadline extension actually makes sense, apparently, a UK court had to actually rule that this was going to happen, and they did. And this gave the two sides time to negotiate, right? I don't remember what day that was, Monday, probably Tuesday, I don't know, Monday, Tuesday, whatever. And then today, Microsoft and Activision formally agreed to extend that July 18th deadline to October 18th to accommodate the renegotiation with the UK. I still think this thing's going to happen pretty quick. One of the interesting things that the CMA said, you know, Friday, I'm losing track of stuff now, but was, hey, I know we said August 29th, I think was the day. We're not going to reinvestigate this case, and we're probably going to do it a lot more quickly than that. So I actually think this is going to happen. It could happen any day, but I think it's going to be within weeks. I don't think we're looking at the fall. I think this happens pretty quick.
Yeah, it sounds like everybody's done. You know what the outcome is going to be. Why wait?
Well, here's why you wait. So let's say you're the CMA. CMA is like, hey, guys, I'll tell you what. Just give us 2 weeks. We're going to write up some stupid document that makes it look like your concession.
We had a plan, yeah.
And then it looks like they did their job. It looks like there was some due diligence. If you come out too quickly with a verdict, it's like, wait a minute, what were you doing exactly?
Yeah.
You know, but if they could, right?
I think the other part of this is summer vacation. They don't want to work in the summer.
Oh, that's fine. Okay. That could be too.
And so it's, and plus nobody's watching. Like, this is a perfect time to take out the garbage. Right. Nobody's paying attention.
Or as we used to say, take out the Euro trash.
There you go.
Yes. So I mean, listen, I've not changed my tune on this as with regards to whether it should happen. I am now. I'm sure I felt like this last week too. I don't remember what I said exactly, but this seems like it's barreling toward this conclusion, you know, that Microsoft will acquire.
I'm going to pay very close attention to the competition group in New Zealand who also had protests, because I suspect they're just going to let that one go, but that'll be fun to see what happens with them.
Well, that's because they're polite there. You know, it's like, we disagree, but let's, you know, if you don't have anything nice to say, just shut your mouth. You know, that kind of thing.
And I think it's just got to be a read of the room. Right.
Yeah.
Let's read the room on this one.
Right. I don't defend the CMA or the FTC, but just looking at it, you know, in the past now a little bit, it's slightly reasonable for the CMA to think, well, it's not going to be just us. You know, the FTC is going hard after this too. Right. We will look like we did something to protect, you know, whatever it is.
Well, and I think this is what Brad Smith's play was. As soon as the FTC came on, it's like, if we break that, the rest will fall in line.
Yep.
And I would argue that was more true before the FTC became as crippled as it's been. Like, there used to be a time, just not that long ago, but generally speaking, when these American groups, and it's not just the FTC, the FDA, the FAA, like, they were the world standard. When they said the thing was fine, most countries signed on at that point.
Yeah,
but they've all been weakened. And, you know,
well, yes, but there's also, so I mean, maybe someone knows more about this than I do, especially outside of tech, but I cannot think of a single example of an acquisition like this where a company has made so many concessions and so many deals with competitors on two fronts in this case, in order to mollify regulators and address the concerns and make this thing happen over such a long period of time.
Yes. And even though the concessions were based on deception to the regulators, like, well, you made concession to regulators that were being deceived by your competitors.
I got to point out, Microsoft is already a convicted monopolist.
Well, hold on a second.
They've made promises which they've broken in the past.
Is it unreasonable
for a regulator or a judge to say, well, thanks for the promises, Microsoft.
There's
more to that than just making promises.
But they never made that point. They never made that point.
But that's not fair either. Microsoft today is not the Microsoft that did that stuff. Microsoft's reaction to this antitrust case is a polar opposite of what they did in 1999, whatever year it was. And all the stonewalling they did with the EU as well. This is like, I always use this example, I'm sorry. This is like saying, well, Germany is a proven fascist state and they will, you know, like that was a different Germany.
No, but we have lots of rules about Germany arming.
Yes.
I mean, okay. We still keep an eye on them, let me tell you. And even the German government has very strict rules about Nazis. They still are concerned.
But that's still true here. So listen, no case like this in tech has undergone this level of scrutiny. We can sort of make that comparison. Like it's like, okay, we still feel like this is a convicted monopolist or whatever. But first of all, that thing was watered down to the point of uselessness by the time it ended. So yes, convicted, but you know, whatever. They also, basically, they settled, didn't they? Wasn't it a settlement?
Consent decree ended in 2011.
Yeah. So, yes, to all of that, of course, but this is a completely different company.
Yeah.
And a completely different era. This is not them running roughshod over the market they dominate.
Right.
Trying to kill competition and prevent other
competitors
from coming.
The FTC did bring up the fact that they had made promises in the ZeniMax acquisition, which they did not keep.
What promises? What do you mean? They took one game away from Sony? Was that the promise? Because if it is Starfield, right? If that's the promise, then what you hold that up against is the 127 exclusives that Sony is wielding over Microsoft. And you say, you know, the balance is still way off. So all we're doing here is giving Microsoft the right to compete on the same playing field that Sony does. And they're not even close on that in that regard.
FTC pointed to Microsoft's record of acquiring and using valuable gaming content to suppress competition from rival consoles, including its acquisition of ZeniMax. Microsoft decided to make several of Bethesda's titles, including Starfield and Redfall, Microsoft exclusive. Despite assurances that it had given to European antitrust authorities, it had no incentive to withhold games from rival consoles. Forgive me, but I understand why the FTC was skeptical of promises Microsoft made in the Activision deal. And by the way, this is in the initial filing that the FTC brought this up.
Right. But what you look at is how many games did ZeniMax release during this time frame that went cross-platform, and it's overwhelmingly in that favor. So
yeah, but my point is that Microsoft does exactly what's good for Microsoft. And if it involves exclusives,
of course.
Well, but that's why regulate them. Yes, and of course it's going to do whatever it's in its best interest.
No, but this proves the point. Microsoft should be allowed to do whatever it wants, just like Sony does. This gives Microsoft the ability to wield the same weapon against Sony that Sony and Nintendo wield against Microsoft. What will happen is, and I say this like, you know, like it's a fact. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that. But it's inconceivable that what won't happen is we'll look back on this 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. I don't care. Microsoft, Xbox, whatever, will have far fewer exclusives than Sony and Nintendo. Because Microsoft, unlike Sony and Nintendo, and this is the reason you go down the exclusives pass, dominate in consoles and Microsoft does not. It behooves Microsoft, because they have failed, to put their games on as many platforms as possible. Their path is the same one it is for Office, for anything else. Put it everywhere. That's how they make money. It's their strategy. It's what they've done with Microsoft 365. That used to be Windows first and maybe Mac a little bit. And now it's everywhere. It's on mobile devices that they don't make. It's on the web. It's on everything. So that's the real proof. That's the real. And all you have to know is what Microsoft does broadly and understand how they're, and look at what they've done specifically with things like Minecraft and apply this to here. Yes, there will be exclusives. There will be stuff. Of course there will. But that's, everyone's doing it like this. That's the market. You know, it's not like they're coming in and screwing everything up by having exclusives when no one else is doing it. They have the right to do that.
As far as I know, everyone's else is doing it is not normally considered an excuse.
It is when you're the minority player in a market in which two other players dominate.
Yeah. And apparently they're not the monopolist here.
Find it interesting to find an American institution defending non-American companies.
Right.
From an American company.
I think it's a mistake to say they're acting on the behalf of Sony. They're acting
We literally don't mean it that way. Okay. But the net effect is a Japanese company is protected, which, by the way, is running roughshod over this industry and needs to be investigated. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, no, I don't think the Sony and, you know, the FTC will like hee-hee in a corner somewhere. But their defense is lined up 100% almost. And we're equally stupid and proven false. And Sony is just trying to do what Microsoft was trying to do back, by the way, back in the early 90s, and maintain their dominance by abusing a smaller competitor. They've been doing it for years. That's all.
All right. I just want to step in and defend antitrust regulators because I think they're doing
I think it's important to note regulation of big tech is one of the most important issues of our era. We will talk about, well, it's not really a big tech thing, but like I said earlier, though, you have to look at every case, right? Individually. This is one case where I'm like, I never saw.
There are so many important fights and this is not one of them.
Yeah. When the FTC sued the block, this in December of last year, I wrote an article called Hey, FTC. I had a picture, awesome picture of a girl, like with a screwed up face. Look it up. It's beautiful. And it was like, you're kidding me. All of the ongoing abuses happening in this industry from Amazon, Apple, Google, Meta. And this is what you're going after? The thing that will not reshape an industry in any way, shape, or form? Really?
Oh, they went after Meta and they lost, unfortunately.
What did they go after? I mean,
well, they went after their acquisition of Within. You know, that's the.
What they should be going after is what the EU's talking about is their abuse of social media and their acquisitions of things like Instagram.
And WhatsApp. I agree. The privacy issue is a huge one. Yeah.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
I don't know if that's. I don't know if that's within.
It's too big of a fight. It's too big of a fight. I think they looked at this.
I don't think they have congressional support. That's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm 100% antitrust and the need for regulation. 100%. This case, no.
Yeah. I don't know how much this is antitrust and how much this is just needing regulation.
No.
But hey, you know what we could do?
What?
Talk about Windows.
People get mad. They say that's the Xbox segment again. It's going on. This is Microsoft. The biggest thing going on in the Microsoft world.
This is the biggest story of the year.
It's not an Xbox story.
This is a $70 billion acquisition. This is business.
Have there been other tech acquisitions of this size? I'm trying to think.
I know it's the biggest Microsoft. I'd have to.
They offered $21 billion for Yahoo, to put it in perspective, a quarter.
Well, Yahoo doesn't even make the top.
They pay for LinkedIn? Not that much.
Eight.
No, it was in the.
Yeah, it was under 10. No, same with GitHub, right?
Okay.
Okay.
I have this. Oh, I haven't published this article. I'm sorry. I looked up the top Microsoft acquisitions at one time. Even Nokia doesn't make the top five.
It was like $30 billion, right?
Nokia. No, that was like 7.8. I think.
Really? Is that all? Wow.
Yeah. I think it literally is a standout by itself. Like, I don't know. At $26 billion for LinkedIn, that was the largest deal.
Yeah.
That Microsoft had done.
I'll just look
until this one.
Where is this thing? I haven't published yet, so. Biggest Microsoft acquisitions.
I think it's LinkedIn for 26.
Yeah. Why can't I find this?
And now
LinkedIn was 26. That sounds right. Yeah. That rings a bell.
And now Activision big. But even overall, like the Dell EMC deal used to be the largest deal at 67. I think the Activision Blizzard was slightly bigger.
By the way, now that I know someone wants us to move on, let me add an additional thing to this. So
yeah,
I've also not
because I don't listen to people when they say move on. That makes me dig my heels in and do more.
No, I will not be bullied. So one of the things I'm looking at broadly is how Activision Blizzard will impact Microsoft, right? And one of the obvious ways you look at it, it's only going to be one of several things in this article eventually, is just financials, right? And so it's an easy thing. Activision Blizzard just released their most recent earnings. So this does not include that. But the four previous financial quarters, Microsoft and Activision Blizzard, will probably be put inside of more personal computing. This is the business unit at Microsoft that has Windows, Xbox and Surface, and HoloLens, not that anyone cares. And that is the smallest of the three business units at Microsoft. It has been there for a couple of years now, probably. So if you add in, if you just say, look, pretend it was part of Microsoft, we're going to take all the revenues, all the profits, throw it into more personal computing, except for the holiday quarter, which is when video games go gangbusters, more personal computing is still the smallest Microsoft business unit, which kind of cuts to my point of, it's a big deal. It's $70 billion. But as far as changing things, this is one indication of how, honestly, Microsoft's cloud businesses, which are Azure and all of the Microsoft 365 stuff, which constitute the biggest chunks of the other two business units, are still bigger. So, except, again, for Christmas. So I just think that's kind of interesting because, and then when you compare it to Microsoft revenues, right? I mean, we're talking about a company, Activision Blizzard, that makes between 1.5 and 2.4 billion in revenues per quarter. More personal computing, again, the smallest business unit in Microsoft, is 13 billion, 14 here and there. Just that little part, just that one third part of Microsoft is, you know, seven times as big. So, yeah, big acquisition. But compared to Microsoft, this is like eating a goldfish, you know, financially, right? This is like if I want to buy a piece of candy down the store, I take it out of petty cash. Microsoft does the same thing, except they're doing it for Activision Blizzard.
And still one of the largest tech acquisitions in history.
Right.
Arguably the largest.
Yeah. Anyway, there's more to that story. I don't want to run the whole thing. I'll read it. But there's so many different ways to look at how this is going to impact Microsoft and Xbox, right? And the others generally, of course, are just gaming related. Microsoft has zero footprint in mobile gaming today. This will change that story. Microsoft has some footprint in PC gaming. Doesn't change that really at all, frankly. Microsoft is in third place in consoles. Doesn't change that in the slightest. Subscription services are good, just like Apple moving to services, right? As their second biggest business. So there's going to be some Game Pass stuff going on there. I think it's going to be kind of interesting. And to a very small degree, cloud gaming, which is the cloud streaming stuff.
I still see this as very much the long play of gaming is going to consolidate around a monthly pass.
That's right.
Microsoft has done the best of positioning at this.
Xbox started out as a console, a hardware device, and then it will evolve over time into a set of services, which again, you know, to the point I made earlier, Microsoft today is about cross-platform, meeting customers where they are. And I think where they want to be is at the point where they're not selling hardware because they're the only ones that lose money doing that and just sell the games to everybody. So there may be a future where there is no Xbox.
Preferably by collecting money from them every month.
Exactly. That's the Microsoft model. They're really good at it. And by the way, Richard knows better than anybody. It started with enterprise licensing back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. What's the term? Software assurance, SAs.
Yeah, volume license agreements.
Volume licensing, exactly. This is, they took this model and they applied it to consumers, and it's been small. You know, Xbox Live Gold, a little bit. Microsoft 365 now, family and
bigger.
It's bigger, but you know, okay. This is the volume. This is when we get out to mobile in the volume part of the planet. So we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Xbox Games Pass speaks to a long-term industry consuming business model, actually.
Yeah.
You know, it's the net, like you'll only watch a show because it's on Netflix. You only play the game because it's in Game Pass.
Oh, look at that. Yeah, that's good. So we'll see.
Okay, when you guys are forced to have a Game Pass just to play games, you can thank me later.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but hold on a second. So we do that with music. We do that with movies and TV shows.
I know.
I mean, this is...
Yeah.
We do,
streaming is the way.
I'm not... We're almost post-argument over ownership, you know, at that point, right?
Right, yeah.
But there is an argument. There's definitely a debate to be had. I don't mean to dismiss it, but
I don't want to own physical media. I don't want to carry it around and all that.
That's
stuff.
Right.
So
and the
I
other thing is,
the convenience
these things are
factor.
Transient.
The problem
is convenience. It's
but are they transient? That's the question. I guess games for sure are, but movies.
Well, in other words, like people. Well, but how many people watch the same movie over and over again?
Yeah. No, you're right.
Right. I mean, I don't know why we want to own these things. By the way, I have 500 movies in my iTunes library. So, you know, hypocrite.
Yeah, but you don't, don't own those. Remember,
that's right there.
I was watching, I can't remember what it was, a movie that I knew very well that had been edited by Apple because apparently they didn't like the sexy scene. So, I don't own that
line across.
They could change it after I buy it.
They just put a picture of Tim Cook's head over the naughty bits.
I don't know who
approve.
It could be the studio. I don't know why
this is happening. This is happening to books too. So I bought the entire James Bond library on Kindle this year as part of a wave of rewriting the past and getting rid of things today that are considered racist or whatever. They're editing those books and a bunch of other books. And I haven't looked, but I believe if I go into my library now, I'm going to have the new clean version.
They'll be edited on the Kindle. Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. See,
so that is the world. I know. I don't like that either.
Yeah.
But I guess the point is, that complaint doesn't obviate the fact that, generally speaking, this system is still better.
It's what people want. It's what people want.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
But the alternatives are harder.
It's better.
I mean, I have ripped all my CDs and stuff to MP3, but it's still a pain in the butt to play that over the course of an evening than it is to just turn on
Spotify.
I go out in the world. I could be in an Uber like we are here. I could be in a restaurant bar like we are here. And there's music playing. My phone, you know, I have a Pixel like you do, Richard, and it tells me what the song is. And I click on it. I go to YouTube Music. I add it to my playlist. And that's how I discover music. If I had to pay for those songs every time, what an onerous and expensive process that would be.
Right.
This is just, this opens up a world of music. Yeah. For a monthly subscription fee, you know, the Game Pass will do the same thing for games.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do? Music Netflix does for, you know, or whatever service will do, you know, does for videos and TV shows. That's the point. I mean, you could pay $9.99 for a movie, or you could pay $9.99 a month for, well, $21.99 or whatever it is a month for Netflix, and have the whole library watch at your leisure. Right? I mean, I know it's not perfect.
This is the path that we're on. And it's certainly the play that Microsoft's making.
Yeah. And it's hard to argue against it when consumers prefer it, and I prefer it. But yeah.
Most consumers prefer the most convenient solution.
Convenience.
So as long as that's a convenient solution, that'll be it. You could make other things convenient. You chose to make this convenient.
Yeah. I honestly hear you. But overall, I still think this is like better, with the caveat that there are pros and cons. I just think the pros outweigh the cons.
I agree.
And not sufficiently enough for you to want to put out further effort for an alternative.
Well, you know what? Okay. So as prices go up, and this is something we've seen this year in particular, right? So Netflix is going up, Hulu is going up, whatever it is. You're like, you know, all right, so what could I do here, right? There are strategies, right? And the first strategy is I'm going to switch between services. I'll use one every month and I'll just kind of binge watch as we go. And that's kind of an interesting thing. But there are people, just like there are people turning to vinyl for whatever reason, or looking at old ways of doing things. Like I have a hard drive that has a bunch of movies on it. I was looking at it the other night. I showed Stephanie. I was like, you know, if it ever happened that we're driving around in an RV or something, we want to be just, we could live off this thing for like a year.
Just getting old.
You know, and never. Yeah.
It's not like there's a lot of new content coming down the pipe right now.
Actually, a vinyl record store opening downtown in Petaluma.
Incredible.
Which blows my mind.
Is it going to be next to an Orange Julius?
No, but that would be nice, wouldn't it? Sam Goody's and Orange Julius together again.
Yeah. Together again.
I think Burke gave me this for you. I think, Richard, this is a TRS-80 video display worksheet.
Oh, yes.
So
27 by 47.
Yeah, so that you can map out the dots on your screen.
Oh, and draw sprites or something.
Yeah.
No, those rectangles you're looking at are pixels in the TRS-80.
That's hysterical.
127 by 47.
That's right.
The video game consoles, the computers, they were all under 200 pixels by under 200 pixels.
That's a weird number, 47.
Yes.
It turns into 1023.
Well, because of overscan, right? Because these were designed for the cathode ray tubes.
That cathode ray tube that did in these eyes.
That's hysterical.
Which is why
I'm going to write Richard Campbell right here in the programmer. We just have to come up with a title of your...
See, the sides are curved. There were no flat screen, screen screens then. It was
That's the bad old days. Wow. Yeah,
it was literally a modified RCA TV, and, you know, I used it from 10 to 12, and it cooked my eyes. No two ways about it.
Nice. You learn basic, Richard. Richie.
You know, you learn basic.
Remember they said, don't sit too close to your TV? Wait till it's your monitor.
All right.
That was the primary advantage of the home computers of the day. Like Apple, they came with an RF.
I have the little analog TV. Actually, this, believe it or not, plays Atari video games.
I'm surprised it doesn't play Doom. It probably could.
Mm-hmm. See, it has a little Atari console. It even has a working Atari joystick. And let me turn it on. You'd have to really zoom in. It's a tiny arcade Atari. Press to start. You press the start button. Oh, maybe I have to do it on the joystick. Yeah. Do you want to play Pac-Man, Asteroids, Breakout, Centipede, Combat, or Millipede? Your choice.
Combat.
All the classics.
Tempest? Pong? Wow. You want to play Combat? All right, let's play a little Combat.
I couldn't see that with your eyes. What's going on here? That's the size of a pixel from the original 2600.
Press the start key. Let's begin. Oh, I started Asteroids. It even makes the sound. I know, it's so small.
It's funny. Oh, that's actually kind of a Space Invader sound, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we just got Taito has released a Space Invaders for iOS and Android that's virtual. Yeah. Did you see that?
Yes. Yeah. So the guy who invented Space Invaders recently gave an extensive interview somewhere. It's probably easy to look up. But here's a beautiful fact about Space Invaders. Everything was so slow then. So when he had many things on screen, it's like, it moves really slow.
Yeah.
So there's a feature of the game where as you kill the Space Invaders, it speeds up. That's just because there's less for the processor to do. And it just became a feature of the game. It's beautiful. Yeah. Isn't that beautiful?
It works.
Yes. It made so much sense.
Making lemonade out of a lemon.
I love that.
Get my beginner certificate in the class I took online at BC, I had to write a Space Invaders game.
Nice.
Yeah, in Racket and Scheme. All right, let's take a break, and then we come back. I'm sorry. I apologize. No more Xbox. Well, until later.
There's going to be a lot more Xbox.
We're going to talk about Windows.
There's more Xbox coming.
No more Trash 80. How about that? But we will talk about Windows in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Cisco Meraki. They are the experts in cloud-based networking for hybrid work, whether your employees are working at home, like our friend Mr. Campbell here at the shore, at a cabin in the mountains in Mexico City, like Mr. Therat here, maybe on a lounge chair at the beach like me right now, if in my dreams anyway. A cloud-managed network provides the same exceptional workspace everywhere, no matter where your employees are. And you know what? You may as well roll out the welcome mat because hybrid work is here to stay. We might resist it, but it's here. And I think if you're going to do it, hybrid work works best in the cloud. And I want to underscore, it's not just employees who love it. It's got perks for leaders, too, because your workers are happier. They can move faster. They can deliver better results. And the key is this cloud-based, cloud-managed network. Leaders can automate distributed operations. They can build more sustainable workspaces with hot desking, things like that. They can proactively protect the network too, because actually security is job one. An IDG MarketPulse research report conducted for Meraki highlights the top tier opportunities in supporting hybrid work. Hybrid work is, according to this report, is a priority for 78% of C-suite executives. Leaders want to drive collaboration forward while staying on top of or boosting productivity and security. And security is one of the big challenges with hybrid work. 48% of leaders report cybersecurity threats are a primary obstacle to improving workforce experiences. So absolutely key in your now in your cloud-managed network is active, always-on security monitoring. That's one of the things that makes the Meraki Cloud so awesome. IT can use apps from Meraki's vast ecosystem of partners, turnkey solutions built to work seamlessly with the Meraki Cloud platform. You can do asset tracking, location analytics. You can gather insights on how people use your workspaces in a smart space. Environmental sensors can track activity. They can look at occupancy level. You can stay up on your cleanliness. You can also hot desk based on vacancy and employee profiles. Employees can scout out a place to work, reserve ahead of time. And if it's a restricted work area, you're going to love this. They can book in advance and they can have time-based access so they can't get in until it's their turn. Mobile device management, very important these days too. Endpoints are everywhere. Integrating devices and systems allows IT to manage, update, and troubleshoot company-owned devices even when the device and employee are in a remote location. They're in Mexico City. Turn any space into a place of productivity and empower your organization with the same exceptional experience no matter where they work with Meraki and the Cisco suite of technology. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit Meraki, M-E-R-A-K-I, meraki.cisco.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting Windows Weekly and these two remote workers here. Actually, I guess you're not technically remote, Richard. Although you're traveling around so much, when you're at home, in a way, you're remote, aren't you?
Yeah, it's all kind of weird. Don't worry. I In August, I'll be in Copenhagen.
Oh, so, nice time to be in Copenhagen, actually.
A great time to be in Copenhagen.
Oh, that'll be fun. So, we'll go to the Tivoli Gardens, wander around. It's a beautiful city.
And eventually I'll organize a shot when I'm up on the coast so you can see the ocean behind me the whole time.
Nice. Do you have a house up there?
Yeah. That's where we're moving to full time.
Copenhagen?
No, to up on the coast. Thank you.
Okay. That makes more sense. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you think he's remote now, wait until he's to the new place.
Really? Yeah. Surrounded by redwoods up in the beautiful British Columbia
Let's just
forest.
Say you have to take a ferry to get to it.
Really?
Yes. Oh, wow. Yeah. And we have Starlink, so the internet's pretty good.
Oh, well, this will be a good test. I think we've had some other people who use Starlink on the shows. I think Jonathan Bennett does one of our, Jonathan? One of the hosts on Floss Weekly. Anyway, back to the show, back to the most important thing in the whole wide world.
More Activision
Xbox.
Stuff.
Xbox. So, no, Windows.
Right. Yeah, the reason we're really here.
Yeah.
So we're barreling to, it's been an interesting couple of years for Windows. In the past years, we've had Windows 11 arrive. Microsoft moved very slowly to update it to address the complaints that everyone had from the first release. 22H2 came out last September. Microsoft has since this time updated Windows 11 constantly at a torrid pace, which has been kind of fascinating. We have instances of features that were never tested in the Insider program going public, et cetera, et cetera. Since then, we've also learned that Windows 10 is being put out to pasture, right? The current version is the final version of Windows 10. So they'll, security updates, et cetera. And there's been rumors of a Windows 12, which we think is coming probably next year, right? And so things are kind of going back to that old three-year cycle, maybe, or getting close to that. We'll see. And then, of course, the Windows Insider program is a hot mess, even more so than usual, because now we don't have specific Windows releases to test most of the time. We just have different tiers, different features. We have ideas about what each channel may mean and may not mean. We don't know. It's hard to say. They don't really talk. So heading into this summer, we're looking for signs, frankly. And Microsoft delivered a pretty good sign. So they said something kind of interesting, which I think a lot of people will not understand because this term does not come up a lot, although Microsoft has used it a lot. And that is that Windows 11 version 23H2, i.e. the version that will come out this fall, September probably, will be released as an enablement package. That means it will be a tiny update. It still requires a reboot, but what doesn't reset is the source code base, which doesn't matter to anybody. But more importantly, the support/compatibility base, right? This is, for all intents and purposes, 22H2, moment four, as we've been saying, right?
Right. You said this. You said, I don't think there's going to be a moment four. It's going to be 23H2.
I think they're the same thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this, I don't mean to say this proves it, but I think we're in the ballpark. I think this is what they're trying to do. Now, Microsoft has actually used this a bunch. So I don't expect anyone to be familiar with any of this stuff. But back when we were doing 2 years on feature updates for Windows 10, Microsoft released 1903 early in 2019, and it was a major release, a version upgrade, right? Source code base update, compatibility, and support update. Well, they're all support updates, but it was a big deal. But when they released 1909, that was an enablement package. It was a minor release, a minor upgrade, and it wasn't as disruptive. It rebooted, came back pretty quick, get a new version number, and most things were the same. They've been doing that a lot. And no one here will be surprised to know that I complain about Windows and updates a lot. but I will give Microsoft some credit because all these years later, literally 8 years later, from the time that Windows 10 was released, in fact, we're plus or minus a few days of that, right? 2015, it was sometime in July, end of July. I think they finally gotten it to where they want it. They now have every possible avenue where they can update Windows in the least disruptive way possible. In many cases, right? Some of them have to be disruptive, but, and we see this with mobile OSs too. We talk about this. Obviously, apps are updated separate from the operating system, but pieces of the OS can now be updated outside of the core OS, being version upgraded or whatever. So, it's gotten better over time. They haven't communicated a lot, so it's confusing. They've changed the rules a lot, the schedule a lot. That's a lot of what we've been talking about this year. And, you know, we'll see what happens going forward. But the most interesting thing to this, and I hope everyone here reads this if they haven't already, mm-hmm. is Microsoft issued a white paper that explained how they service Windows, as they call it. And it includes Windows 10 and Windows 11 because they're the two supported versions of Windows today. I don't care as much about Windows 10 today. Obviously, we're kind of moving forward here, but it is fascinating to me that 8 years after they released Windows 10, they're now documenting how they serviced it over that time period in a way that they never did during those 8 years.
And the fact that they call the document 1.0.
Exactly.
Isn't that just a clear implication? We've been making this up, but we decided to write it down. Would you like to read it?
Thank you for saying that. That's 100% correct. Exactly. So they have been making it up as they go along. And that's sort of, I guess what I'm getting, I don't mean to suggest it's not going to change going forward. I mean, my God, it's been changing all year. But that the very release of this document suggests maybe now we're going to have a formal, maybe they've reached the point where they feel good about it.
A group of folks got into a room and said, how do you want to do this?
Yeah.
And then so somebody decided to write it down.
For all the complaints, I will say the appearance of this document, like you said, 1.0 form, it's classic.
So as soon as I saw the number, I'm like, classic. Really?
Yep. You couldn't have just 7.3'd it and pretended you were doing this all along internally.
Because you would have asked for earlier versions that did not exist.
It would have been so guileless. It's beautiful. Anyway, but they retroactively pretend that there was a strategy for Windows 10 and they show how that changed over time. When in fact, as you said, making it up as they went along. Mm. And now we've got Windows 11 where they don't go into all of the details about, you know, they don't talk about moments, for example, right? But that from a very high level, one annual release, which may or may not have been what we used to call a feature update, right? So enablement package, still a feature update, but it's really the same code base from the previous version. So it's a lot less difficult on the user base. I don't know this for a fact, but if you think about how Microsoft rolls out any major version of Windows, there's this system where like the PCs we know to be most compatible, we'll get it first. And then if we get good feedback, you know, we expand it. And you see there's like a several month range where this thing starts getting deployed out into the world. I think with an enablement package, that's not necessary because if you're on 22H2, you are compatible. It's the same system. So that's kind of interesting.
I have to wonder if this almost wasn't initially an internal doc to leadership. You know, that the eye of Sauron largely hasn't been on Windows for a while.
For sure.
And so there was a swing of the eye back for a moment going, what is it you people are up to? And they had to kind of decide what they were up to.
Because all we see when we look at you is a new version of Paint. And what is this stupid phone app?
and ongoing PSS complaints about versions.
Right.
So to me, the other piece of this that gets really interesting is, and I've seen this over and over again in Microsoft, they tend to publish things when they want to end internal arguments.
Yes.
This is what we've now said publicly. We have to follow through with it or explain why we're not going to.
For whatever it's worth, it's a good document. Like I said, it's worth
it. It actually does explain stuff.
Yeah. It doesn't go into the depths of, you know, if you just look at, like I do, at a very granular level, what can happen with regards to Windows updates on a yearly basis, a monthly basis, a weekly basis, a daily basis, right? I kind of really dig into that stuff. They don't go that far down, but, you know, if you think about it, like feature update once a year, like they said, features rolled out throughout the year, monthly, typically, right, through cumulative updates. It kind of covers everything I've been talking about. And app updates, of course, are separate. But,
this is transitioning leadership changes and everything and through this course of this document, right?
Yeah.
Like there's a subtext here of, and then new leaders came in and this happened.
Well, remember, so when Windows 10 came out, it was very confusing, right? They made a big announcement. Everyone on Windows Phone 8, everyone on Windows 8 and 7 will get this for free.
Right.
And then Terry Myerson said the dumbest thing. Well, he said a lot of dumb things. But one of the dumbest things he's ever said, which was, we will support Windows 10 for the lifetime of the device.
Right.
What? That's not a thing. Now that Windows 10 is concluding, what we can see is actually it followed a fairly traditional 10-year life cycle.
Totally. Support life is the typical lifespan of a given piece of hardware.
Exactly, which is, okay, fair enough. Yes, of course. But also typically the lifespan of a version of Windows.
Right.
Right? So for all of the changes, Windows as a service, as they called it at the time, now we call it continuous innovation, and we try not to throw up in our mouth a little bit. really, it's the same life cycle, essentially. Yeah. Now, I actually believe with Windows 11, that's going to change. And they're going to do what they wanted to do, which was cut down on those things. And the reason I believe that anything
less than what they did in the initial period of 10, when they were being pushed to try and do the release early, release often thing, until the customer was screaming, not just the engineering team. I mean, everybody. Well,
there was a lot of, let's just see if we can get away with this. And there was a lot of businesses saying, yeah, no.
Well, so they had that kind of, it didn't provide the benefit, right? I mean, the bill of goods we've always been sold with rapid release is that it will get easier over time and it will also be better. And for certain products, that is true. But yes. I think we've now, what Windows clearly demonstrated is it does not apply to operating systems.
The interesting transition that's going to happen here, I believe, and I think we all believe, is that Windows 12 comes out next year. And so the difference between Windows 12 and Windows 11 is that Windows 11's predecessor, Windows 10, was bumping up. It made sense for it to hit that 10-year life cycle.
Right.
They weren't going to be in market for more than, 3 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. With Windows 12, Windows 11 has only been in the market for 3 years, or will have been. Mm-hmm. And I think there's going to be something different. I think that in the same way that Windows 11 was just a version upgrade to a new version of Windows 10 that we're going to call Windows 11, I think that Windows 12 will be that to Windows 11. And it's going to be very interesting to see how they handle the support life cycle of 11. I don't believe it's going to be 10 years.
No, I don't think it'll be shorter because it's a shorter lived version. Like you're starting to see the short-term support effect happening.
That's
an impact. Almost seems to be a natural byproduct.
The support lifecycle. So if you go back and think about all the releases of Windows, 95, 98, 2000, XP, all the interim stuff, and then Vista 7, 8, whatever. Mm-hmm. These things came out not exactly every 3 years, but we'll call it every 3 years. But every one of those was 10 years of support. So at any given time, you had multiple versions of Windows that were supported by Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
When there were security vulnerabilities, they had to be updated,
And the 10-year period with a 3-year cycle meant you could routinely skip versions and you had incentive to do so.
That's right.
If you pick the XP 710 line, you were much happier than the 2000 Vista 8 line.
Yeah. And actually, that's a nice little system because for the customer, whether people or businesses, you're skipping versions. You get what is a major release. It doesn't matter how minor every upgrade is. When you skip a few or one even. You get
it. Well, we never believed there was a minor release with that. Updating an operating system was always disruptive. So you might as well do it as rarely as possible.
Yes.
And typically on the hardware cycle, the bigger thing for me when I was in IT is upgrading these machines is not worth the pain. You're replacing them on a lease cycle every 3 to 5 years anyway. And so you just ship them with the new OS.
And you said this some time ago on the show. 10 years is starting to look like the hardware cycle too.
Yeah.
And that kind of matches up neatly. The only thing that would change that is Microsoft's artificial hardware requirements where they, like they did with Windows 11, even though systems on a core i7, i6, maybe even i5, whatever, would have run Windows 11 just fine.
Oh yeah. Well, and ultimately did.
They artificially cut it off. And I think that's one of the ways we get to that shorter support life cycle for 11. Well,
and I'm going to argue in favor of the TPM4. We need more intrinsic security. Yes, it was an artificial constraint. They chose to demand the TPM and then they arguably backed off on that. That wasn't a bad cause.
Yes. And actually, at the time Windows 11 was released, the TPM 2.0 requirement was nonsense because it didn't give you any advantages over 1.2. No. But actually, since then, they've released some security features for Windows 11 that do require a TPM 2.0. So I'm not going to pretend they had this plan. I don't think they're that smart.
I think they're feeling their way forward.
But it happened. So, here we are.
Yeah. The situation is better for the most part.
It is better.
And, I still don't know what laptop to buy, but the situation is better.
I can tell you what I just bought. Mm-hmm. You might be interested in. Framework just started taking pre-orders for their
16-inch.
The gaming.
Yeah,
with I've been staring at that
too. Ryzen 7 and available graphics card.
I have been begging. I talk to PC makers all the time, obviously, because I do the reviews. And so one of the weird, with this move to 16-inch laptops, they're starting to plump numeric keypads in there.
Yeah.
I'm not disputing that some people need or want that, but I don't. And I said, I don't understand how that can't be modular and give me the option to have speakers
and
there.
That's exactly how Framework does it.
Exactly. And that's why I saw that and I said, that might be the one.
Well, and you know the boss is a heavy duty CAD user, and so she is a big fan of keypads. Like that's definitely a feature.
Yeah,
for
some people are. Yeah,
and so we're both planning after the move is settled to change laptops.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, she actually needs more torque than I do.
Yeah. So she for in the workstation class, 16 inch, you know, portable. Yeah,
this might be the one.
There are a lot of choices out there.
Yeah. The heavy the T series Lenovo's. The Delosaurus.
Look at W Series Lenovo's too, by the way.
Yeah.
One neat thing about these, and I have the Framework 13, the disadvantage is they don't feel quite as solid, right? Because it's all modular. Yeah. But they are 3.2, at least on the 13. I guess the 16 won't be. It has to be 16.9, right? But
16.10, I would think.
16.10. It'd be weirdly tall if it weren't. But they're upgradable, and they held on to their promise because I can get this AMD Ryzen 7 in my 13 if I want to upgrade that. So
no, this is
cool. Yeah, it's really cool.
I feel like their end game is going to be they have influenced or through laws required other PC makers to do this, and then maybe this company unfortunately kind of disappears or gets acquired if they're lucky.
I don't know if that's true. I think they're going to – I just ordered and it won't come. This is the problem. I ordered it and it won't come to the first of the year, or first quarter.
So here's – but
half a year, that's a long time.
In writing
– well, it's because they're in such high demand.
In
writing reviews of laptops, like the two big trends that have occurred over the past several years is, aside from 16 by 10, thank God, is the move to sustainable computing where you have a lot of recycled materials.
Recyclable,
I just forgot what I was going to say. And the user serviceable stuff. So in the beginning, you'd have like a device where like some PC comes out and you're like, oh, you can replace the SSD. That's fun. And then you flash forward 2 years and it's like you can replace the RAM, the SSD, you can replace the wireless things are all in M2 cards. You can upgrade them. You can change them out. You can do whatever you want. So it's not a framework, right? It's not the whole platform. It's not whatever, the speakers, everything. But they are moving in this direction. So we'll see. We'll see where it leads. But I love that you can have a keyboard without a numeric keypad on this.
Right, if you don't want it.
That enough caused me to perk my ears.
Well, and even you can add it after the fact or take it out after the fact if you don't want it.
I love it.
It's all completely, they have spacers. I mean, it's this new one is more configurable than the 13.
And then the modular just expansion parts are
you get six of these and you choose what you want. USB-C, A, DisplayPort, micro SD, HDMI, Ethernet, audio.
I think it's great.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
I ordered one. I won't get it till next year, but I'll do an unboxing in a because I ordered it.
That
with
kind
it
of
as
demand,
parts.
By the way, kind of that's going to cause people in the PC industry to pay attention.
Oh yeah, they're sold out. Like this, they just opened this up a few days ago, and I dithered, and I should not have dithered because now it won't be for months. I'm on like the sixth or seventh shipment.
If you don't mind me asking, how much did you spend on this?
I think it was 23, something like that. But I got, so you can have it they have M2 storage base. So I didn't populate the second one because it's standard Western Digital M2s.
SSD.
So you can put your own in later down the road if you want.
There are other things that go in at M2 as well. I mean, you could probably, I don't know, what would that be?
I figured 2 terabytes, but, I mean, that's what I usually get on my laptops. That's going to be enough.
Yeah.
And you can replace any of the parts, including the battery, which of course is the first thing that goes on these things.
Of course, yeah, but it's neat. You add some kind of USB port. You're like, I'm not really using this, but I am using this other thing. You pop it out, get another.
Port that's there. What happened with the 13. I didn't use one of the ports very often. I think I got an HDMI port, so I replaced it with a little removable SSD. The little secret is these are all USB-C. There's 6 USB-C ports, and they make these modules that they slide in, and you can have it be USB-C to something else.
I think it's great.
Yeah. I love, this is the most interesting to me, is you can choose a slimmer, non-GPU kind of backplane, or you can choose one with a GPU. Or you can buy both. And when you want it light and thin, take it out and put the little one in if you don't need it. I'm pleased that they're doing this. Yeah. It's probably not the best, in X86 laptop out there. As you said, they're probably.
But that's not the point.
That's not the point.
Exactly. For people who want this, I mean, and it gets better over time. Like this one, like you said, is already better than the 13.
Yeah, I was very impressed. That was the question. Are you guys really going to allow me to upgrade? And are you going to allow me to upgrade the motherboard? Yes. I can upgrade the processor? Yes.
Listen, this is a win-win, right? People aren't buying new computers every few years.
Right.
They might want to upgrade a part. So this PC maker wins. You win.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
It's a funny reversal in cycles, right? Because this is the way the PC market used to work. And then along came the MacBook Air and the Ultrabook.
And
then we pushed to make everything one piece. Yeah. That's how Tim Cook made it work. Like,
well, this is
see what the hardware
with,
guy does.
Same thing with phones, right? Same thing. We're starting to see a reversal and back maybe to, head back to...
Over to modular phones.
Right.
And that's got less to do with I want to customize my own way and more to do with maximizing.
I was we were talking about Windows IT Pro. I was at their offices in Fort Collins, running up the stairs and my Samsung Focus whatever fell out. It blew into four different pieces. And the woman, whoever shows behind me, said, oh my God, that's so... Yeah. I said, no, this is what happens. Pop it back together. Off we went. And that was the point. It was like this little plastic back. It popped you off easily. The battery came out. You know, the SIM card probably went flying. But you pop it all back together. Everything's fine.
It was
good. That's how phones used to be.
Well, and the replaceable battery meant the phone lasted.
That was the point. Yeah. And instead of traveling, you see people with these stupid USB charges plugged into a phone. You can take a tiny little sliver of a battery, pop in your pocket, don't even notice it, and you have all the battery power you need.
Yeah.
Let me correct myself. It's as ordered, and I ordered kind of top of the line everything except for that second drive. It's over 3,000. So, right. But it is workstation class. It's a Ryzen.
That's the price.
7040 series. I think I got the Ryzen. I can't remember which one I got. And the different modules. And I actually got a variety of modules just so I could.
Play
with it a little bit, you know. That was part of the fun. So, yeah, this is
it's USB, so they're hot swappable too, right?
That's right.
I assume.
Yeah. I got the Ryzen 9, which is pretty high end.
Overkill.
Yeah, 7940 plus the Radeon RX 7700. Well, I want to play Valheim on this. You know, that's
32 or 64.
I'm guessing 64. I went all the way.
There you go.
Yeah, and it's amazing they're not offering. An Intel version of this. It's just AMD.
Is that true? They don't have an Intel version? Wow.
No, I can't find one in the list.
Yeah, you might be right. I bought, you know, the original one was Intel, and I was able to go from whatever, the 9th generation to the 12th generation.
Can you not love a company that gives you the option between Performance Pro and Overkill?
Yeah. So I'm clear, this was Overkill?
Yes. Obviously.
Oh, no. Every number you've stated has made that clear.
Okay.
Obviously. 9 series, 64. Yeah.
64 gigs of DDR5.
I'm guessing you get a full HD screen on this thing.
I don't know what the screen is. You know what? I was resistant ordering it because there were a couple of negatives in the old one. Battery life wasn't great and the screen wasn't great. I just read a review. Somebody got one and reviewed it, I think, on The Verge and said the screen's very nice. And that was like, okay, fine. I will do it. And I thought, for a while, I've been thinking, I'm never going to get another x86 machine. I love these Apple Silicon machines so much. Sure. But then I realized, oh, wait a minute. I need a Linux machine. So...
Did you notice they offer you a keyboard with nothing drawn on it? Just blank keys, like very Neuromancer.
I got the clear keyboard with RGB, and they have little Raspberry Pis in the back. I don't know what's going on. I'm going to you should order one, Richard, and then you can explain to me what I just bought. Because I don't know what I kind of went. Crazy.
I might have to order the blank keyboard just to have a blank keyboard.
I think it's pretty cool, right?
That's just a different league of cool.
Yeah.
I wouldn't personally, but I don't need
keycaps.
Keycaps are for the weak.
That's for the weak.
I can't see those keycaps. My hands are on them.
Well, more saliently, my eyes aren't good enough to see those characters anymore anyway, so why not leave it black like it's intentional?
I got the clear ANSI. I may regret this.
I mean,
but the beauty is I can get another one and just pop it in, right? If I regret this. So you see the circuitry behind it and it glows.
And that's important.
I guess. It's only $49. If I hate it, I'll get one with keycaps. It's pretty hysterical, though. Look at it. It's clear.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one I ordered. Call me nuts. I'm actually not a touch typist. This is going to be a real challenge. I don't know. If you get...
Wait till you... You know what? It's going to raise its head when you're writing code. Now you're going to like, where's the damn slash whatever?
That actually, probably I know where the things are with coding. Probably, I'm thinking.
Okay. All right. But, we'll see. We're going to find out.
If you get if you get emails from me that the characters are displaced by one row, just, you know, should be able to decode that pretty easily. If it says Q, it's an A, right? If it says A, it's a Z. You can figure that out. Burden's on you, buddy. All right. Are we? Did we have anything more to say about with Windows?
Yeah, there's a lot more. So.
Oh, good. Keep going.
We don't have to go over this too much, but there's one interesting point here. So last week there were two insider builds, the beta and release preview channels. This week, today, actually, we got a dev build out. Outlook, we know, is coming to replace Mail and Calendar at some point in Windows 11 or 12 or whatever. It is now an inbox app alongside.
Call it Outlook Express just for old times' sake?
I wish they
just
would, because honestly, actually, by the way, you should, because it's why do we have 18 things called Outlook? Yeah. Like, what are you doing? You know? So no, they won't, but they should. I agree with that. But the more interesting thing is, I mentioned this from time to time. I mentioned it today. Most of the channels in the Insider program don't map to a specific release of Windows, whatever, right? Oh, Windows 11 in this case. So last week's build, rather, moves the beta channel into 23H2. So if you want to test what will come out as Windows 11 version 23H2, that right now is the beta channel. Eventually that will, you know, migrate into release preview. We'll see. So that's finally happened, I guess, if that excites anybody. In better news, I would say, remember we talked last week about the NUC going away?
Yeah, I love the NUC.
I do too. I've won three of them. I'm a big fan. I'm happy to say that ASUS has signed an agreement with Intel to do two things. One, to support all of the current NUCs that are out in the world. So
that 10, shocks
11,
me.
12, 13, yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll create new NUCs based on Intel's. They're getting all the NUC, you know, stuff. So they
okay.
have a license.
I mean, in the end, it's just a mobile chipset. So I was wondering what they thought when they said we're going to make NUCs. Like,
I believe it also has to do with just the motherboard design, because it is, you're right, 100%. Mm-hmm. Although there are gaming class versions, right? The big ones. So I think Intel probably still makes reference designs, which they can or cannot just use, you know, and they might keep, I guess they're going to keep doing that. I'm just excited that they're moving forward with this. And then
the deal must have been, hey, we'll sign this over to you and do nice PR if you take over the tech support.
Yes.
Like, so and here's the warranty.
Here's the asterisk. Others can do what ASUS is doing, not for supporting the old ones. That's ASUS. Right. But others can license the NUC designs and go make new NUCs too. So this might result in a world of more NUCs.
Yeah. What I thought the NUC was all about in the first place was Intel building a reference design to encourage others to make it. So getting out of it to do that. Okay.
I've never seen one, but apparently there is actually a laptop version of a NUC. But to me, the interesting thing was,
even that's not,
I don't know, but there's a, we've moved to kind of mobile computing. And one thing I think most people probably don't think about or realize about the world is that these U-series mobile chips are 100% they're what 99% of the world needs, right? You can put one in a small form factor computer, and there's all kinds of interesting ways those things can be used. They don't have to be mobile computers. So it sounds like, you know, mobile computers used to be where we had like the last gen stuff or, you know, the less powerful computers. But these things, for most people, perfect.
Powerful enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I've always had a NUC living in the kitchen attached to a Dell touch display.
That's great.
Right. And it's just an easy way to do the recipe thing and all of those capabilities. But, and ASUS has always made mini PCs, but not NUCs, not exactly that form factor.
Oh, that's interesting.
There are actually a lot of companies that make these small form factor,
PCs.
But you go to the well, right? You want to get it from the source.
Do you really want to get it from the source? I mean,
yeah, I think so. I did.
I mean, I would argue that the component costs will go down if they're all using the same form factor. because now they can cross manufacture.
Yeah, like, I mean,
there's a bunch of advantages for
sure.
Right?
If you thought Surface was a boutique PC maker, let me introduce you to Nook. You know, there are 3 users. They're very happy, most of them. Small. So, but anyway,
but the most common thing is seeing that mounted on the monitor.
Yeah, like a base mount. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just sitting on the back of the monitor.
Yeah, and it was designed specifically to that size and shape, right? So that would work. You unscrew the screws, you screw it back in. You know,
it sits on the VESA mount. Then the other thing I would add to that is you get a slot expander, right? The USB plugs, SD slot, that kind of thing. You mount that to the base of the monitor, and then you plug that into a USB-C port on the NUC. And,
then you have like a little expansion. Yeah, it's nice. I mean, hopefully your monitor actually just has that built in, right?
Isn't that the interesting truth? Guy, changing coasts. We sold the big TV in the media room with the media room. So it's like, oh boy, I need to buy another TV. And then it's like, oh wait, I have another TV and it's already got Plex and Roku and all that stuff in it. We need nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. Hang a knuck on that and you're done.
Man, I love it.
It's fantastic.
That's very old school, you know? I mean, especially since you can get a Roku for $43 or something.
Yeah, but this is the same size as a Roku and it's a computer.
Yeah.
So
do you have the wireless
and the Roku is in the PC anyway?
Yeah. Right. No, I know, but I mean, do you really want to use a PC on your big screen TV?
Do I ever not want to use a computer, Leo? I don't.
It's an interesting idea. Yeah, I think the NUCs are really cute. We've always loved them.
When Media Center was a thing and we had remote controls.
Yeah, that made sense.
Yeah. I did miss Media Center, man.
Even NUCs have fans. They're not silent, right?
Depends on the NUC.
Okay, you get a quiet NUC.
Yeah, you can get a solid state NUC.
Silent Nook.
That's the boot up chime. How did you know?
Nook. All is calm.
Windows desktop.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, I guess Apple really still makes a Nook. They still make the Mac Mini, and I have one right here.
Yeah.
That's as much a Nook as anything. Well,
it is, but I mean, compared to most NUCs, that's actually pretty big, right? Yeah,
it's a big NUC.
It's probably twice as big. Yeah.
It's a big NUC. No, you're right. That's right. Yeah, because NUCs are that.
Yeah. Well, almost literally VESA sized. VESA mount.
It's 100 millimeter square.
Yeah. And you can load them up. That's what was the cool thing about the NUC is it made a lot of stuff that size because it's still fun. Supporting it.
I added a lid that had two additional USB front-facing USB ports on it.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, because there's a connector inside, there was an additional M2 if you wanted two drives. What Richard was talking about is really kind of perfect. You do the USB hub or whatever off of it.
Right.
And you can leave you never see the computer. It's just behind, you know.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
Discord's singing, sometimes you feel like a nuck, sometimes you don't.
Nice. Nice. Hey, do the jokes here, guys.
Yeah. Come on. Easy.
Mostly, I steal the jokes, but anyway.
Oh, that's good. That's fine.
Yeah, it
works.
Insider program is, where are we?
All through it.
Microsoft has a new font.
Yeah, so probably wrote about this 2 years when they 2 years ago when they announced it. I don't remember, but apparently 2 years ago they announced they were looking for a new font. It took them two years.
Fonts are hard.
Hopefully not the same designers that worked on the Windows 11 Start menu, but whatever. These fonts have actually been available in the font drop-down menu in all the major Office apps for this time period. So if you wanted to be using any of these all this time, you could have been, and they'll remain in there going forward as well. I got to tell you, maybe I'm missing the point. I actually don't like this new font. I tried it in Word the other day, and
You like Calibri when it came out?
That's the thing. I don't remember. I do hate change, so probably not.
Ideally, these fonts, you don't notice that they're fonts, right? They're just there. So this new one's called Aptos, which is funny because that's also...
They changed the name of it because the original font's name meant something like beer house in German.
Bierstadt means beer town.
Beer town, sorry.
Bierstadt.
So
a much better font name, I'll be honest. People don't know how to pronounce Aptos. Is it Aptos? Aptos? What is it?
Yeah, exactly. So the thing here, like, there was a time when the default font was Times New Roman.
That's a terrible right. font.
Which is terrible.
It's a terrible font.
Well, it's that or Arial, right?
And then they moved to Arial, and then they moved to Calibri. I think that was the...
Yeah,
was
pretty much.
I think that was it. So, I don't know. This one, I'm not feeling it. I don't know what to say. We'll see what happens.
But. I mean, they all look like variations on Arial. They're all sans serif fonts.
Yep.
Like, I just don't know. What is the difference between Aptos, Grandview, Seaford?
They
put them all in.
They're subtle.
It's like, gee, you had a tough time ticking between them. I defy you to be able to identify them if I line them up beside each other.
You know how designers are, though. They can see the difference. They go, look at
I like how the examples are all these things no one would ever make in real life. So this is how we did, you know, we can show you what it looks like or whatever. Yeah. It's like, I don't know.
It's not the best display of a font I've ever seen. There's people, it's busy, it's crazy. Yeah. There's a lot of non-font stuff.
No, this does not make you love the font.
Yeah.
This is never the way you're going
Plus
to look at the font in the first place.
Radioactive colors. It's just weird.
Yeah.
It's just weird.
I can't tell the difference between these. I really can't.
Aptos, California, Redwood Country. That's not true. That is not Redwood Country, but okay, fine. It's just a little suburb of Santa Cruz.
You're such a stickler for
I know Aptos. Believe me. I went to high school in Santa Cruz.
You're no Aptos.
And you're no Aptos, my friend. Yep. Does it have, here's the key, ligatures. Do you even...
Is that the key?
That's the key to me.
Expended my interest in this topic.
Okay, enough. It ain't no Xbox. I'll grant you that. I'll tell you that right
Thank
now.
You.
Thank there, you there very you much.
That's all
you need. All right, let's take a little break and then... okay, did, you get the Richard, choice. Did, flip a
Richard,
coin.
Did you change that headline, Richard? Is that you?
Did you which that? Headline?
AI told you so.
I did not change that, but I should have because that's good. A good time. What was it before?
I must have written that during a blackout then. I don't remember that.
And funny. AI told you so. AI and Xbox coming up next. I almost hate to say that because I know that many people will say, well, that's it for this show. Bye. But there's brown
whiskey.
Liquor. There's a good whiskey coming up. Our show today brought to you by Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E. Collide is a device trust solution if you use Okta. A lot of companies use Okta. It's a really great solution for authentication. But the problem with authentication is just because somebody's who they say they are doesn't mean they're logging in on a secure system with a secure machine. Collide ensures if a device isn't trusted and secure, it can't log into your cloud apps. And believe me, if you work in security or IT and your company's using Okta, you need this thing. Do you notice one thing in common over the past few years with data breaches and hacks? One thing in common, the employees. Now, this is not to knock employees, but this is that's kind of the weakest point in your peripheral perimeter defense, right? Sometimes an employee's device gets hacked. Maybe they have unpatched version of Plex on their system or something like that. Sometimes an employee leaves sensitive data in an unsecured place. You know, the API secrets in the downloads folder, that kind of thing. And it seems like every day a hacker breaks in using credentials phished from an employee. Wouldn't it be nice if you could avoid all of that? You can. But the problem isn't your end users. It's the solutions that you're using to prevent these breaches. It doesn't have to be this way. Imagine a world where only secure devices can log into your cloud apps. In this world, phished credentials are useless to hackers. You can manage every OS, including Linux, all from a single dashboard. Best of all, you can get your employees to fix their own device security issues so you don't create more work for your IT team. Well, here's the good news. You don't have to imagine this world. You could start using Collide. Collide does it all. Visit K-O-L-I-D-E, collide.com/WW to book an on-demand demo today. See how it works for yourself. collide.com/WW. Make sure you use that, too, so they know you saw it on Windows Weekly. K-O-L-I-D-E. It's really cool. collide.com/WW. Now back to Paul and Richard, and AI told you so. I love it.
I clearly need to change more headlines.
Right. I was going to say, actually, it was Richard who told us so, because I don't know, 2, 3, 4 weeks ago, whenever it was, you said, and I love saying that because you said,
sir.
It's so accusatory.
Did you or did you not say, sir?
You did that. This was, I think you said this exact price, that this was going to be a very expensive add on to existing tiers of Microsoft 365.
It's funny because I thought the same thing when I saw this price. I thought Richard was right.
I believe you said this exact price.
Yeah. Well, and not that I had any inside knowledge. I was just doing the math and saying this is about where it's going to land. What I find fascinating about this story was they announced it at Inspire. And the Microsoft stock price went up 5% in an hour.
I thought that was bizarre.
It's crazy. Well, he makes money, right? So we should mention the price is $30 a month per user.
Oh, right. Yeah. Sorry.
$30 per user per month.
Yeah. So in the commercial space, Microsoft has a vast variety of Microsoft 365 subscriptions, right? Per user per month. This is on top of some subset of those, I would imagine, or any of them, or whatever it is. So it's sort of like things like there's lots of add-ons. You know, it's like when you're buying a car, do you want this, you know, CD changer in the trunk or whatever. These are things you pay for on top of the normal subscription. Teams Premium is another version of that kind of thing, right?
And the extended security for email and so forth. If you don't have an E5, I mean, a lot of that stuff comes with E5, but E5's pricey. I think lots of people buy E3 with the P1 security package.
Yeah, there you go.
Right. That's your sort of typical combination. And so I always looked at this from the context of a P3, from an E3, because E3, an E3 is, I mean, you're literally talking about doubling the cost.
Yeah.
You're coming, an E3 is like $35 a month.
To an individual, you see $30 a month on top of the normal subscription fee. And you think, I don't pay that for almost any subscription, except maybe TV, if you pay for that kind of thing.
Right.
And it seems very expensive. And it is, to be clear, it is. But these types of fees for these types of add-ons, there's nothing like this add-on, but for other Microsoft 365 add-ons is... Yeah, it's still expensive, actually, but it's in the range.
Yeah, and therein lies the question, right? So I'm talking to a buddy of mine who runs IT for a 500-seat place.
Right.
Right? So he's talking an additional $15,000 a month. It's like...
A month. No, that's if every single person gets it, right? And that's... Right. That's
they the don't tier. Have to use it. They just have to pay for it.
Yeah, but you also don't have to give it to them. So most organizations obviously have some form of organizational units and, you know, sets of users. They all get different, though they can, right, to save money. Yeah. If we know that these guys out in the field are never going to use full office, we can get them the cheapy one, which is access to the web apps and, you know, email on their phone and so forth. So you can play that game.
Sure.
But man, you're going to pay and it gets complicated. But
you realize when you start doing the math around salaries and so forth, it's like, and a performance improvement of an information worker of 2 or 3% is far more valuable than the cost of this. Yep. Like that's what it comes down to. If you saved a couple of hours a year working on a PowerPoint deck.
That's right.
You paid for that subscription.
That's right. This is the example, I don't know anything about PowerPoint. But once or twice this year, for some reason, I have to make a presentation.
Right.
So what I'm going to have is a bunch of downtime while I figure the stupid application out.
No. The other side of this is I'm using PowerPoint 2022. Mm-hmm. I have PowerPoint 2007 skills. And so making my slide look good takes hours.
How do I get my 4x3 slides from 2007 to look right on a 16x10 display?
And to have the Copilot take that on for you and just, I mean, there's already good recommendation engines and things in PowerPoint to make it look better. Some of them are not good.
But at this price, I mean, I don't know how price sensitive corporations are, but at this price, it's going to be, you have to justify your.
The problem is.
Like I said, Leo, you say if a given worker saves 2 hours a year, you've paid for the year.
Yeah, I understand that, but.
For that user. Right, so the user's going to have to
make write a proposal saying, look at the time I know you will spare.
You can't know. That was the conversation. So you can't know until the end of the year. And I don't even know how you really know. Maybe it worked for Bob. It didn't work for, you know, Matt. It did work for him. Like at some point, I think it really does make sense to kind of filter this down to only those users where
Well, and now we talk about Veeva, right? Because Veeva is the new branding for corporate surveillance. And
so hold on a second. So you're paraphrasing the Microsoft marketing because
maybe a
sure
little bit. Yeah, I shortened that up a little. Just a little.
Yeah.
But it's like, how are we going to know they're using it? Well, Veeva will tell us if they're using it.
That's beautiful.
That's reality.
Veeva. Did Veeva come out of the where everyone's working from home and now we don't have the
100%? Veeva is a product. Veeva is a set of products that were developed internally for Microsoft that they've ultimately productized and expanded the set from there. Microsoft has been struggling since the beginning of Office 365 to surface the graph.
Right.
That's right. True. In ways that don't upset people. They've surfaced it many times in ways that do. Right. See Delve and, you know, other products. Like it's very easy to get creepy surfacing the graph.
And I think that's what Veeva is. It's an unwanted intrusion into Paul spent, 16 hours in Teams meetings last week. And it looks like he's been, playing Call of Duty the rest of the time or something.
You're on it, right? Like that email you get from Veeva that says, hey, you said you'd do such and such for someone. Did you do it? And that is because it's only talking to you. It's less upsetting than it's sending it to your boss. Right. And they're pretty careful about not doing those kinds of things. But all of this is an exercise and this is incredibly valuable information. What I like about Copilot in this scenario is it flips the script. In the old Delve days, when you were working on a document, Delve would pop up and say, hey, Gladys down the hall has already worked on this document. Super creepy. Yep. Right?
Yep.
If I now say to Copilot, hey, I need to build a TPS report, the fact that Copilot, because of the graph, can say, you mean this TPS report? I've just saved you a ton of work. You asked me, you told me you need to do some work, and I made that work less difficult for you.
Richard, are you turning into an AI apologist? Is that
what I'm really not. Right? I mean, that's why I clearly label this. This is corporate surveillance, but it can occasionally be beneficial.
I'm just kidding.
Because remember, I've also lived on the Exchange side. I've been through e-discovery for harassment where we were going through all that email. We were responsible for pulling that information and we were supposed to be on top of it, right? Like, let's be very clear. Corporate assets that you use in your work are owned by the company, as is all information that moves through them, and they are liable for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's part of that secret job being an IT guy is you know when anybody's going to be let go. Because you have to turn their accounts off.
I'm kind of confused. I'm sorry.
It's all the same problem space. It's that there is information that exists within the network because of the network flows, and you have to use it responsibly, but you can't not use it.
We know that Windows Copilot has been publicly tested. Is Microsoft 365 Copilot out in the world?
Not really. They just announced. The only place I saw it was largest customers getting previews.
Okay,
Inspire. They are starting to do more rollout.
I feel like I would have heard about it and remembered that. So it's curious to me that they have announced pricing on something they have not let people see and understand the value of.
Well, they've set certain customers see, but all the more reason they're testing the price.
Yeah.
So they finally decided they had to put the pin down. They figured this was the right time to do it. They got the nice stock price spike. We'll see what happens.
I was surprised by that. Of course, I don't understand Wall Street in the slightest, so my whatever.
I think the prognization of AI is a big deal by a large company. Name me another tech giant that has productized a large language model.
Yep. Okay. No, you're right. I guess in my mind, I was looking at the price of this thing and thinking you're excited about this. Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
No, I think that's the real statement. I mean, to me, the bigger thing was, all right, now you have a sense of how much this thing costs, that this is the kind of dollars they're going to have to charge to make it worthwhile. Right? Microsoft pays every day to operate that infrastructure. And more importantly, and isn't working it for other profitable workloads.
Yes, it's and to the point I've been making for months now. I don't think people understand how expensive these workloads are on servers.
Catastrophically,
right.
GPT-4 far more than GPT-3, and it seems the emphasis here is all 3, 3.5, 3+, like they're doing everything they can
to keep it to the lower resources.
Something they're likely to make money on, because I think everyone's sound getting sense that they may not make money on four. Like I said this a while ago, but it's like, I don't know that four survives.
Or there's some hardware events, which Microsoft and others are trying to make happen, where, you know, they tailor their chipsets to this kind of thing, right?
Perhaps. And Moore's Law does still apply. Eventually, the hardware will be cheaper, but that's a couple of years from now, and nobody's going to wait.
And ChatGPT-5 will be out by then.
You raised such an interesting point that I hadn't thought about, which is maybe why it's expensive because it costs that much to do it. But it's also good. It's also a benefit that it's that expensive, because then people will use Viva. And Microsoft would love everybody in every company to be tracked and the data sent back to the home office.
Well, you think you missed a point on that, which is if you're using M365, the data is being logged.
You're already being tracked.
It's just a question. Right. It's being done. It's only a question of who's looking at it, right, and how they're looking at it.
Right.
Viva just makes it easy.
Viva's for the front end for the employer. But Microsoft's getting it anyway, is what you're saying.
But I don't know that Microsoft's necessarily measuring any of that. But what Visa is the wrapper to stop you from being sued, right? for not being discrimination. I mean, this is a problem I dealt with all the time as an IT person. We roll in a new version of an application. I now watch the logs as that application's being used for a couple of reasons. One is I'm seeing if the new version is actually going to take the system out because it has some problem that while it wasn't an immediate crashing bug, it is eating resources and is going to kill off the system. And so I'm watching that, but I'm also watching are the new features being used? Like, they cost me additional resources that I'm, you know, now spending. This is when I'm running my own data center stuff, right? But also, like, what parts of the organization are using the new features? Because if they're not using them, we're missing productivity. We spent money writing the software. If nobody uses it, it's a complete waste. So we would do targeted training. It's like, hey, this team doesn't seem to be using these new features. Maybe we just need to educate them better on that. Now, there's a path of doing that at scale where it's discrimination, right? Where, you know, you're now scrutinizing workers, saying you're not following the workflow that we recommend. So I'm going to, you know, insist on additional retraining. And if you pick it by individuals, then it can look like discrimination. But if you pick it by policy,
right,
then it's not. And you need software for that to abstract that. And that's a chunk of what Viva does, is provides that access to the graph to show where training is applied successfully and not.
I could tell you're Canadian, because here in the U.S., we are free. And we don't have to worry about that at all. We just say, you need training, and, you know. That's that.
Oh, no, I'm going to put it in a different way. That kind of brings us full circle. We're in the U.S. and we're just going to let AI do everything. God damn it.
There you go.
It works it out. It just doesn't matter.
These hoops were for jumping through your literature society, not ours.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. But I have to say, one of the benefits of AI is it gives you plausible deniability for everything you do, right?
Let me get this back on track with AI. And introduce my new favorite acronym or oxymoron, which is Bing Chat Enterprise, which was announced today. And
what a great line,
Bing Chat Enterprise. It's like Barbie for business, you know, like what? So there anyway, exists. I'm not going to talk about that at all, but apparently it's a thing. And yeah. Separate from that, Bing, the Bing we know and love or whatever, which has the AI-based Bing chatbot, has picked up support for visual search, which is something people are probably used to.
Useful, yeah.
But yeah, you can upload images to it, obviously, and it will search the web and find new ways to steal images. So that's fun. Bing. So I don't know. Did you read the Bill Gates note?
I also read it right beside the one he wrote in 2012 about how dangerous it is with what Google was doing.
Interesting. Okay. This is the second time in the past, I don't remember time frame, 6 months he's opined on AI.
Mm-hmm.
Now that Microsoft's doing it. That's interesting. I didn't know. Okay. I'm interested in that.
Well, what led to OpenAI was Bill and Elon being on the same page after Google bought Jeff Hinton and that whole crew out of the University of Toronto and added them to Google Brain. there was this real concern that generative AI is being controlled by laboratories inside of Google.
Yeah, so make it open and
make it open and it'll be better, right? Yep. Said the company that then hijacked the entire thing and turned it into a corporate enterprise.
Well, Microsoft is going to be Microsoft.
Well, and to the, you know, the more salient, one of the salient points around that is a group of billionaires got together and said, hey, we're going to set up OpenAI. Not just Elon, but Reid Hoffman and Peter Thiel and so on. And how none of them did it. They didn't do it.
I was going to say, how many evil laughs do you think there were during that meeting?
Well, and they double evil laugh of, yeah, we're going to do this. And they didn't actually do it. Elon kept saying, hey, I put $100 million into OpenAI until someone actually looked at books and went, where? And it turned out it was like $15 million and a dozen Teslas.
That's weird because he's usually not one to spread misinformation. Strange. So for those who haven't read it, Gates has a site, by the way, and he writes these blog posts called Gates Notes. Hilarious. And if I were to boil this down with the word generator, it basically says, we've done this before. There's nothing to worry about. And kind of dismisses the fears of AI, especially AI taking over the world and dropping missiles on us or whatever.
I mean, and I don't disagree with that point. I'm more making fun of the old complaint when the other guys were doing it. Like, if it wasn't clear to you that this is corporate maneuvering, not a concern for society, just put the two statements side by side.
I mean, with AI, I feel like we've gone through the seven stages of grief. And he's written more eloquently to this topic than I have, although I've made some of these same arguments. If you look back in time, technological advances, the train, you know, the car, whatever, you know, we had similar issues, right? It's like, you're killing jobs, you know? Yeah. The job is selling horses. I mean, you know, yes.
Now, the thing is, AI is not going to take your job. Somebody using AI is going to take your job.
Yeah. There you go. Which is interesting because there is someone pointed, I couldn't think of this word last week. Actually, just now that I'm talking, the democratization was the word I couldn't think of. There is a democratization of technology that Microsoft, by the way, was and probably still is very good at, like bringing these supercomputer things down to the general populace. I think that was a big strength of theirs. And this notion of, like, you had to have a specialist doing a certain job and now you can have someone else plus AI. Right. It opens that type of job up to more people.
Yes.
Probably less pay. You know,
it's a commoditization of skills, and Microsoft's been the ultimate commoditizer. Right. It's just take technology that usually was fairly difficult to access and make it simple to access, even if it's not as good as the original. So it's sufficient.
I will say the word I was searching for and not finding last week was democratization. In this case, I believe your commoditization is a much better word. Yeah.
That's good. Because democratization intends some sense of nobility.
Yeah.
Commoditization is about blowing out the market.
Exactly. No, you're right. 100%. That's good. So I would say if you're interested in AI, it is worth reading. I'm not sure he wrote it, honestly. I mean, maybe that's why it's so real. You know,
it probably is a Gates bot somewhere.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm not as fascinated with Gates as many people are. Obviously, more.
Well, including Microsoft these days, like, they're very arm's length with him.
Well, for good reason.
For various reasons, yes.
So, it's interesting. This one's interesting. So I don't read everything he writes. I thought this was interesting.
He often feels to me like it's full of bromides. It's almost like, well, that's a little obvious. Like,
But I honestly, I think a lot of people. Insightful. But he spelled out the major concerns, and I honestly, for a mainstream audience, I feel like this is what we have.
Yeah.
We haven't gotten it from
He carries a lot of gravity, and arguably those things were not written for us as folks who focus on this industry all the time.
I mean, the people reading this think he invented Apple, and it's fine. The idea is simply that he is speaking to a mainstream audience, and I was like, he kind of hit all the corners, you know.
So. So that's interesting. I didn't even really consider that. That's the Gates notes are for normals. They're not for.
He's not inspiring today's tech leaders. I can tell you that.
Right.
No. You know, like, at all.
So what is? So why does he write this? What is he?
Because I think he's a big topic guy now.
Right.
He, he doesn't lead a company, right? So I mean, he has his foundation, but he's this is like, look, I've been around the block. And I, honestly, I do think that part of the message, you know, we've done this before is correct. And this is, like I said earlier, I've made this argument myself, not as well as he does, but, you know, the advent of the car, the train, you know, the factories, whatever. Yeah, good and bad. That's the point of technology. The goal is we emerge on the other side net good, hopefully, right? And right. And that's kind of his point. He goes into way more detail.
Richard, you're kind of an AI naysayer. Do you think he gives AI too much credit in this?
No, I don't. Actually, I think he picked a pretty good line. I don't think he has any special insight there. He's just Bill Gates. I don't disagree that I know these technologies have weaknesses. I'm not anti-technology by any stretch of the imagination, but I know a hype cycle when I see one.
Yeah.
And we're in one, so yeah. Our judgment is severely impaired, right. Including mine.
Right. No, mine too. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. You have to acknowledge that, because that's what I meant by the seven stages of grief. I think we all went through this. Oh my God, it's changing everything. Oh my God, the world was then and now it's now. You know, it's like, and then after a while, you're like, oh, okay. And now I'm at like, I think it's like MSG. It's a little flavor enhancer. You sprinkle it on something else and it makes it a little bit better.
And too much of it and gives you a headache, right? It's all very reasonable. Yeah.
I think the thing we're learning is where it is useful and where it's not, you know, it's been oversold as useful for everything.
Which is the nature of a hype cycle.
Right. Unlike blockchain, it actually does turn out to be useful in some circumstances.
Right. And by the way, not to, I mean, it's July.
Yeah.
For the world at large. Yeah. It's only been since February. So.
Well, and now, you know, the other angle I had on that is I have seen the trough of disillusionment destroy the usefulness of the product, too. Yeah, so moderating response to me seemed important.
That's a good point.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
One of the indicators that AI is, in fact, important to some degree, right, is that these months since February feel like years, right? Yeah. Time is
moving
contracting.
Slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, I think that speaks to the fact that this is not a thing we're going to leap past and just forget it ever happened. You know, it is here and it's going to have
this
some
is impact. Not 3D TV.
That's right. And possibly not the metaverse. We'll see. The jury's still out.
One thing that does worry me, and you brought this up, Richard, is the difficulty and cost of getting the raw material for the large language model.
This is my argument against it. GPT-5 is that I don't know that we have enough material to justify a larger iteration.
There was just an article about what they're going to do instead, which is some sort, instead, because the internet is too unreliable for really a good model. So they're going to do
Let's be clear. GPT-4 is a perfect manifestation of the internet.
Yeah. I mean, don't we just need
it? Hallucinates and lies to you? Really?
Ooh, how exciting. They're going to do some, I can't remember the name of it. I bookmarked it. I'm looking for it right now. But they're going to do some sort of synthetic data that's partly a creation of humans, partly the creation of other AI. It's basically the mad cow disease of AI. They're going to have AI consume AI.
I love it.
Which seems
There was a great paper at MIT of test versions of exactly this who showed data degeneration.
Of course.
When you used to make JPEGs out of JPEGs until they turned into blobs, which, by the way, doesn't happen anymore because the JPEG algorithm has improved to the point where it recognizes sufficiently compressed image and stops.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And so part of these, what they're doing is the right thing, which is quit slamming more data into a limited algorithm. Start improving the algorithm.
Yeah, this was a Financial Times article. I just found it. Why computer-made data is being used to train AI models. Computer-made data does not sound like, or synthetic data, does not sound like the ideal input for AI. Well,
and I don't know that I'd count on the Financial Times for precise titling of technology.
Well, that's true. They're taking the name from a press release somewhere, I think.
Yeah. Maybe the future advances that will be consumer-facing will be ChatGPT 3.something-based. Like, in other words, we'll keep advancing along that line.
Yeah. Well, and the bigger thing is just recognizing that the additional parameters buy is nothing except additional power consumption.
So Sam Altman said that he was pretty confident soon all data will be synthetic data. Oh, geez. A chief executive of Cohere, which is a LLM startup, said if you could get all the data that you needed off the web, that'd be fantastic. In reality, the web is so noisy and messy. This is, again, a quote from the Financial Times, that it's not really representative of the data you want. The web just doesn't do everything you need.
Do you know that old computer phrase garbage in, garbage out?
Ego. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cohere, as well as several of its competitors, already use synthetic data, which is then fine-tuned and tweaked by humans. Synthetic data is already used, says Gomez, even if it's not broadcast widely. Get this. This is what they say it is. For example, to train a model on advanced mathematics, Cohere might use two AI models talking to each other, where one acts as a tutor and the other as a student. They're having a conversation about trigonometry, says Gomez, and it's all synthetic. It's all just imagined by the model. And then the human looks at this conversation, goes in, corrects it if the model says something wrong, and bada bing, bada boom, you got a large language model. That doesn't like a good way to do it.
Well, the argument is the large language model would work great if all the data was accurate. And I don't know if that's true.
But if the data being generated by two other AIs, I guess, yeah, if it's accurate, I guess.
We're teetering way off target here.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead. Didn't mean to disrupt.
No.
We have an AI segment on Twig, and that's really what the show will be talking about. So I'll defer to them.
Bill Gates talked about AI. That's the hook.
That's all there is to say. We're done.
We've gone up into some weird, I don't know.
I'm sorry. The FTC investigation is way more useful because as much as we make fun of the FTC, their job is to protect consumers, and there is a conversation to be had about the risks to consumers with this product.
And this is the thing I was talking about earlier where, you know, you look at it case by case and I look at their arguments for looking at FTC and I'm like, yes, I think this has to happen.
I mean, to me, the simplest piece of regulation that I just see no downside to is publish your sources.
Right.
What data did you use in the model?
I talked earlier about a document that people watching the show would probably be interested in reading. I do not recommend reading the FTC's order. It is blisteringly long and detailed, but they want answers for everything.
Right.
We want to know exactly where this data comes from, how you get it, whether you believe or not that you're violating their privacy. Like, did you steal this? Did you scrape it? It's incredibly detailed.
It's also a reasonable set of questions.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not disputing that.
And as we know from Sam Altman's congressional testimony, he's always perfectly frank and forthright in all his answers.
You guys have been very well trained to speak to Congress.
Yeah.
As compared to Bill Gates in 1996.
Right. Yep. He's like a Satya Nadella bot, but just trained specifically to talk to regulators and lawyers and politicians.
I'm sure there's a $300 an hour service to train you on that stuff.
It's AI-based. Yeah.
I mean, I hope they do a good job. I think this is a logical investigation to leave in place for some time while this is going on. I think it's important to acknowledge that an investigation is not an indictment. It is literally, hey, we see a risk to the consumer here. Show us what you're doing so we can help assess that.
Yeah.
Because you know what OpenAI would really like is for the FTC to come back and go, yeah, all good. You guys are fine. Nobody's going to be hurt by this.
I don't see that happening.
Yeah, it seems
what's
unlikely.
The likelihood?
I don't see that happening.
Right. And
not a betting man.
By the token, it's like you shouldn't fight this because fighting this basically says, oh, no, we know we're hurting people. We just don't want you to know how much we're hurting people.
I just wonder how forthright they're going to be in answering these questions.
I think
they have never been forthright about any way that they do anything. So this will be fascinating.
Yeah.
Yep. You thought the Activision Blizzard documents were redacted? This is going to be just black pieces of paper, you know?
But again, how many cycles on that bloody merger when you could have been working
on
this?
It is a little bit like asking Coca-Cola, well, what is your secret recipe? We need to know if it's safe.
Well, right. I think that's very reasonable. The FDA did ask all of that. And phosphoric acid has serious issues with your body, too, by the way. It pulls calcium and magnesium out of your bones.
Wow.
But does it taste delicious, Richard?
Yes, it does. Especially just with a healthy dose of Captain Morgan added to it.
It was a New York Times crossword clue, two-word adult beverage, and it was rum and Coke.
Is three words.
Well, I mean, two ingredient. I think with maybe two ingredient beverage. Sorry. That's probably what
yes.
it was.
There
you I go. Wrote gin and tonic first, but then I realized it was rum and Coke.
That would be my call, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Much better. Let's do
Jack and Coke.
Because God knows there could never be too much Xbox news.
Goodness knows.
You sort of said that felt a little sarcastic.
No, I mean it. I love it. I am all in on the Xbox now, man.
There's been a lot of Activision Blizzard news. Some weeks that's been the Xbox news. This week there's some other stuff, so it's kind of fun. So Microsoft, after 22 years, will be getting rid of Xbox Live Gold and replacing it with Xbox Game Pass Core, which is a significant upgrade. Actually, the price isn't going up. You're getting 25 free games to start every month. There'll be more in the future. Multiplayer gaming, of course. Okay. And it kind of aligns with the other Game Pass subscriptions pretty nicely. I think it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was. We knew that, and now it has happened. The prices for what is now called Xbox Game Pass Console, right, which was originally just Xbox Game Pass, and Xbox Game Pass Ultimate have both gone up, right? Subscription services are going up all over the place. That was kind of telegraphed. And this will take effect on sometime in September. When it does, if you are paying for Xbox Live Gold, you will automatically be pushed into this. And I kind of went deep on this. This is not really worth going too deep on the show, but when you kind of go point by point with all the stuff you get and what changed, I mean, the big thing here, other than the advent of Game Pass and the need to have something that makes sense with Game Pass, is that Microsoft has had this feature or perk of Xbox Live Gold and also Xbox Game Pass Ultimate called Games with Gold, right? And I don't know originally if it was two or four, but at one point there were four games. And over time, it gave you, during the lifetime of your subscription, access to a big library of original Xbox, Xbox 360, Xbox One games. And obviously they went through all the Microsoft stuff. They went through all the third parties that agreed to allow these things to be published here this way. And they ran out, right? We've just run out. And so
hit them all.
Yeah. We hit the last year or so. It's been two games, not four. The quality, or I don't know, quality is maybe not fair, but the recognizability of these games has gone downhill dramatically. So in lieu of that, what they're doing is that 25 plus, it will be more in the future, games that you get. And
I'm sorry,
starting with,
did you say 25 high quality games?
Well, yes, because what they are this time is, I'll call them catalog games.
Right.
So they're games like Doom Eternal.
Now, I'm good with this until you put Fallout 76 on the list. Like, that's where
it is on the list.
You don't like Gears 5. You don't like
that? Did you ever play that? I love that game, unless you play it, in which case you find out it is one of the most broken games ever made.
Oh. Okay. But the point is, they're starting with Microsoft Studio and Bethesda titles. Third parties there might be a third party title or two in there, I guess. Yeah. But more will be coming on board. So this kind of replaces the games with the gold thing. And I mean, honestly, nice. You know,
they needed to consolidate this. It had gotten fragmented. Yeah. You know,
it maps nicely to the Game Pass offerings.
And I'm a Game Pass. I bought Game Pass goodness knows how long ago. I think it was given to me as an MVP, but I pay for it now. And now I'm going to, because I just don't play games on the Xbox. I am from a part of the PC Master Race, for goodness sake, right? Like, I'm not doing it. Xbox is for running Plex.
Wow.
There are games. I would say Diablo 4 is much better on an Xbox than it would be on a PC, just because of the controller. Really? And
you're playing it on your PS Portable, I see, with that hand gesture.
No. All these years later, and we're arguing consoles versus PCs.
I am not arguing at all.
It's obvious.
No, you're not arguing. You're just saying you're right. I mean, like, I'm not arguing with you.
Because I know
your position is ridiculous. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, okay. No,
that is correct.
Okay. So it's the second half of July now. This year's flying by. And Microsoft has announced the second set of games that will be coming out through the various Game Pass subscriptions. Once again, I don't recognize any of these. So I don't know what to tell you.
Serious Sam is...
That's a great game. But that's really old.
Serious Sam. That's not in there, is it?
Yeah, in the list, yeah. It's Serious Sam, Siberian Mayhem.
I'm sorry. I completely missed that.
I'm sorry. Cloud, I'm reading PC, your Xbox Series article.
Yeah.
Your article.
Back when I was still a PC gamer and I was looking for new shoes, I went through
classic.
I
mean,
those times loved, before you were lost. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I loved Serious
Sam. Oh, yeah.
And one and two. Wonderful.
Great. So I've never great even, titles.
Yeah. Yep.
I never heard of Siberian Mayhem, but I presume it's the same game.
There might be a reason for that.
When you look at the more recent Doom games, and people are like, oh, they brought Doom into the 21st century. No, they didn't. Those are Serious Sam games. Yeah. Those are modeled after Fast and Furious. You're running in such a way that it feels like you're on ice. You know, they're nothing like Doom. But they are a lot like Serious Sam. And you might like them. It's fine. But, you know.
Now I'm looking up the first 10 minutes of gameplay from Serious Sam.
Siberian Mayhem.
Because I wonder if it really is, you know, a Serious Sam game or some other.
Or something else.
Man, it's cold.
Hey.
But kicking ass warm me up.
Yeah, it's Serious Sam.
This looks like Will Rock.
So this really is Duke Nukem
It's Duke Nukem. Right? I think this was...
Actually, if you look up the game, look up the game Will Rock, this is exactly what it looked like.
So I think Duke Nukem was the original and was a success, and Serious Sam was a competitor that...
But it was unique because of the kind of frenetic nature of it. Right?
It was a great game,
It's just a Russian blasting away with different weapons game.
Yeah, like and a kind of an attitude.
And just the sheer amount of stuff happening at one time was what made it fun.
Yeah, the Duke Nukem's line was, I'm here to kick ass and chew bubble gum and I'm all out of gum.
Right.
Right.
Which became a classic. Yeah, I mean, that was like, that has entered the culture regardless of whether you're a gamer or not.
Sure.
Okay, well, there's a lot of shooting.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that was the pitch on Serious Sam was all the action and none of the brains.
Yeah, none of the plot.
None of the plot. You're just running around.
I'm going to confuse you with the plot.
This is a Serious Sam game. It's good. You're in Siberia is the only difference.
Well, but it gives it a different locale because the Serious Sam game was originally kind of tropical.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a different background, basically. Yeah.
It's different texture maps.
Yeah, same exact game. You're like, this seems familiar, but it looks different.
Yeah.
All right. So,
the main thing is you fire it up and you know what to do.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Right.
So good. No, you get this with the games with gold. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Very nice.
Microsoft last September introduced a preview of something called Game Pass Friends and Family. You may only know about this because last week I talked about how the $1 offer for Game Pass was back.
Yeah.
This is what was supposed to replace that. It was so successful, they're canceling it now. So the less we say about it, the better. It's going away.
Again.
Yeah. So that's okay.
So this is not Games with Gold anymore. It's called Games with Core. What is it? What is the new?
No. So they've gotten rid of Xbox Xbox Live Gold.
Yeah.
The original Xbox subscription.
So it's Games with Core?
No, it's called Xbox Game Pass Core.
Yeah. But it's games with...
No, it's not games with anything. It's Game Pass Core.
Okay.
But as part of that subscription, you now get it starting in the beginning, 25 games.
And then
you can download and play on your console.
And then these new ones...
Oh, I should say they're... Go ahead.
Sorry. Is this with the Core or no?
No. These are... This list of games spreads across Xbox Game Pass console, PC,
okay,
and Ultimate.
You understand my confusion.
Yes, actually, I do. You're right. Yep, it is confusing.
And this is a simplification.
Good. Thank you.
I mean, we're still talking about Microsoft. I just want
to... Maybe I can get Bill Gates to explain it to me. Can he write a Gates note on...
With Gates notes on Game Pass.
Yeah. On Game
Pass. I mean, they should have called it Game Pass R2. I don't...
Community Edition.
Preview. So I've been talking a lot about retro games recently. It's fascinating to me that all of a sudden I didn't do this because it was exploding, but I did it on the side and it is exploding kind of alongside what I'm doing. So it's fun. There is a new retro game collection coming to Xbox Series X and S in 2 days. It's called, what is it called? It's called, it's called Anstream Arcade, which is kind of a strange game. It is 1,300 retro games.
1,300.
Yeah, that just seems like pressure. Right?
That's got to play them all. Are they good games?
Oh, I didn't say that, Leo. No, I mean, of course, like any collection, there'll be good games, and there'll be games like, huh? You know, I don't remember.
Oh, they've got Amiga games. You must be happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
Amstrad games. I don't know who's happy about that. Mm-hmm. Arcade games. Let's see which arcade games. Joust 2.
There you go.
Rally X. Classic. Rampage. Nice. Okay. 8-bit games from Atari.
Fun.
Kissin' Cousins. Oh, they got Star Raiders 2. That's a good one. Battle Zone. That's good. Well, this
that
is
a, was great on
the this event. Is like yeah. these are. I mean,
a little bit of everything.
Day of the Tentacle on DOS. That's fun.
Classic.
And that's classic, and that's going to be weird on a console because
yeah.
Well, I guess you selected the words
Worm Blaster.
That's a Lucasfilm game, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Tentacle. Genesis games. I mean, let's see what Balloon Boy. It was timely at the time.
Not as funny. No.
I don't see any Sonic games, for instance. So yeah,
you're not going to get the first party. Sonic, yeah, because they did their own things, right? They sold their own.
Right. MSX, NES, PS1.
Wow. Okay.
ZX Spectrum for our Brits.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. 1999. And Frisky Tom for the 5200. So that's an interesting mix. It's an interesting mix of platforms. So this is obviously some emulator that they've packaged.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found ROMs that they could get away with.
Yeah.
Basically.
Well, that's a rather curt way to describe their business plan. But yeah, yes.
I like it. I think it's great. And yeah, that's cool.
Hey, the more retro games, the better. And the rationale here, but this will be another thing I'm working on, but a report came out about some huge percentage of games from the 1990s and older, and especially from like 83 and older, are just not available. Like they're just gone, you know. Yeah. And I think it's
important. And emulators will save them. The question is, do they need saving? I don't know.
I don't have the retro bug from that era.
Yeah. So they should be in a museum. I get that.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Like NAMPACs
with other non-PC platforms. Is that
it?
Yeah.
A lot of early digital art does not stand up well, but it is part of our history, right?
And I think our memory of those games is superior to the
experience. Okay, but in many cases.
I don't know. I've been playing some of these. Like, I got to tell you, there is something to be said, and it might be tied to the fact that they had to struggle so hard to get things within the constrained resources of those systems.
There's a level of creativity.
And they really focused on gameplay. Some of those games are still very fun to play.
Yeah.
Not all of them. I mean, obviously, there's so many hundreds, thousands of them, whatever, but not all of them, obviously. But some of those classics are classics for a reason. Like, they really are kind of fun.
Oh, and to add more fun, you can buy it for $30 a year subscription or $80 for lifetime access. And according to Paul, one in every 10 pre-orders will be upgraded to lifetime access. So if you feel like a little gambling, they could throw that
there
in.
There you go.
10% if we can add gambling to professional sports, I don't see why we can't add it to
everywhere.
Well, wait. You mean every mobile game?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah, those. You mean loot boxes?
Listen, Richard, you've brought up a lot of inconvenient truths today. I got to say, it's hurting my heart.
Rich is becoming the annoying guy.
Becoming?
He's the truth teller. No one likes that. Mm-hmm. All right, coming up, get ready. We've got the back of the book, the tip of the week, the book of the week, run as of the week, and brown liquor of the week coming up next. Let's kick things off in the back of the book with Paul Thurrott and his tip of the week, Paul.
Yeah, so GitHub some time ago announced that we're going to be getting rid of passwords, right? And or password-only logins, I should say. They're still going to have passwords, but you can't just log in with your username and password. So this will push people to 2FA or physical keys and or physical keys, I guess.
Yep.
And now they've announced support in preview or beta, I guess public beta, for passkeys, which is one of those things that can kind of sit alongside those other things, which I find to be very interesting. So we're starting to see this in, Chrome is doing this and some services are doing it. I think the way that GitHub does it, honestly, is particularly good. And if, of course, you have to be a GitHub user, but this is worth looking into. It's kind of an interesting step forward to a point where I think we're going to get rid of passwords. Mm-hmm. It's elegant. So in other words, you have to sign into GitHub for some reason. Maybe you're at the command line, it brings up that browser prompt, or you're literally at the website, whatever. You can type in your username and password. If you have 2FA, you can get a prompt and do it on your phone, or you can use a passkey. And I just think the way the passkeys are nice because they integrate with your device. And so, like, in other words, 2FA, it's on your phone typically, right? You have a Microsoft Authenticator app or whatever.
Right.
Passkeys can be on every device. So if you have a secure way of signing in on your computer, which you do, Windows Hello, right? Facial recognition or a fingerprint, that will sign you into that service, right? It passes through. It doesn't replace any of those other things, although I think it might replace physical keys. You might know, Richard, but
I still use physical keys with my GitHub account.
I think they're in, I think they're comparable. But I like the thing I like about passkeys is they're on the device.
Yeah. So and whatever device. Well, the big thing was the tie into Hello, because suddenly a lot of the machines you already own are.
Yeah. So for example, today, an example Leo will appreciate. For some reason, I was signed out of everything on my browser, and I went to sign into Mastodon. I'm using Leo's search with social. And I, of course, I have a.
By the way, you're one of our most active posters, so I want to thank you. You really use it. I'm very grateful.
But the problem was on. So I have to do a 2FA key. So I grab the phone I'm using, and I'm like, it's not in there. Oh. What's going on? It's because it was on my iPhone. Yeah. So I have my iPhone. That's no problem. I brought it out and did it. And what I should be doing is putting it on here. But with a pass key, it doesn't. It's not tied to that one device, right?
Isn't it? Isn't
it? Is not.
Don't you have to have that iPhone to approve it?
With a 2FA, you do.
Yeah.
But with passkeys, you do not. That could be on any of your devices. So once that's
one
the point
of your devices,
key.
Because they're not that, transportable.
Which you sign in securely.
Yeah.
Right?
So you can have multiple
devices.
Oh, yeah. You can have multiple devices, which means you have multiple passkeys for the same site.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Which is what I've been doing with
HTTP. I mean, like that.
Yeah. You have separate YubiKeys?
I have a bunch of YubiKeys because you should never have only one.
Right.
And so it's normal for me to register several with a site.
Well, I do that too, but you carry one on your keychain and that's the one you use all the time, right?
I guess the
And for my personal machines, I've got like a little micro in the keyboard already, so I don't have to grab the other
one. I use, as I mentioned last week, SSH. So I send, for every machine, I send a public key up to GitHub, and then I don't even have to think about it because I have the private key, and so as soon as they see me, they go, "Oh, let me see. Oh, yeah, that's you."
But this, I hate to make a callback to a sponsor, but why don't we make a callback to a sponsor? Like, this is what Collide does, right, with the device specific security that we're getting with Windows Hello for some sites now. Where if you're on your usual machine, authenticated, done. As soon as
I don't like about passkeys is how many passkeys you end up creating.
But you don't. It's not like you manage them, right?
No, because you have a new passkey for every site, though, Richard. I have one YubiKey that works on all those sites.
Yeah, but the passkeys are totally transparent to you. You don't even see.
That's right. That's what I mean. You're not managing anything. It's not like you have like a passkey library you have to take care of. You know.
Well, you get a new phone, you've got to somehow get that passkey library over to the new phone or else.
Not somehow. It's actually very easy. You just sign in through your secure authentication on the device.
Yeah. It's just the authentication strategy.
On Apple with the iCloud because those keys are stored in iCloud.
I should say, excuse me. So the thing I said up front was there are different ways to handle this. I love the way they do it. Chrome has one extra step I don't like. Mm-hmm. So there are different implementations, but the idea here is that I should be able to go to a new computer in this case, sign in with, use Windows Hello, go into a browser. Now my passwords are all there and blah, 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 whatever. And then sign into GitHub and it will give me options. I can sign in different ways. One's a passkey. It will create the passkey the first time on the computer. Seamless. I don't have to go to 2FA over here. I don't even have to have this phone. It's wonderful. 2FA is great. Like 2FA is more secure, obviously, than just passwords and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes you don't have the phone. That just happened to me.
Well, and especially at home. To me, I like the fact that when we're traveling, and even I pull up my usual laptop, it goes, this is enough different. I want more authentication than this.
Yeah. With passkeys, you have the choice. And when you do, and again, if it's done right, like that was my point. Look, if you are in GitHub, go see how they did it. I really like the way GitHub implemented passkeys. That was literally my point. That was the enable this and see how they did it. Because this,
I'm just excited that the no password thing is starting to come true. You know, in certain places, with certain effort, there is a solution because it felt like there would never get off of passwords.
Right. And I think this is it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm not a security expert, obviously, but I see that future here.
Yeah. It's plenty secure. It's just a question of we haven't had a problem with security in these new methods. We've had a problem with implementation and convenience.
That's right. That's right. A lot of it has to, for one of the tenets for security should be, if it isn't, for it has to be seamless and easy for normal people to use.
Right.
If it isn't, they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
And I feel like the way Chrome did it was like almost. I really like with 2FA and the Microsoft account, I never have to type in anything other than my user account, the email address. I get a prompt on my phone and I'm in and I'm done. Like that's really.
I also, of course, I'm living in the IT land. Like we have tiered security for a reason. I'm strongly encouraging sysadmins to use token keys like YubiKey because their accounts are targeted. And right. Same for business compromise stuff that senior leadership should be doing
but level security. So 100%. But I mean, for my mother, my brother, I mean, normal people out in the world.
It's too much for them in the first place. And they're not targeted the way that a business leader or a sysadmin is targeted.
A YubiKey with a lightning adapter on it that you stick into an iPhone will be the weirdest thing that most people ever do with their iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, like it's just unusual.
Yeah. And they will lose it inevitably. Yeah.
Yep, 100%.
Right. I don't think YubiKeys. I think this might be the beginning of the end. Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of do too, actually.
Yeah, I think there were a transitory period. I think we're getting to better solutions now. Yeah.
Well, maybe not better. Maybe people like you, Richard, and I will continue to use YubiKeys. But
we're fine.
Yeah. But normal people, you know.
They were never for normal people.
This isn't. They were never
for guys. Normal people out in the world, please listen to me.
Don't
listen to these guys.
Don't.
They use the same password on every site, and it's easy. Yeah. What are you worried about?
ABC 123.
That's all you need. I get
2FA on it. It's fine.
It's everything. It's fine.
Okay, so I don't have an app, but I do have a book. I was very excited to see this appear in my collection, my Kindle library. I'd forgotten about it, but John Romero of id Software fame has written an autobiography. And actually, when I wrote this, I said, I'm actually 20% of the way through it. I'm blowing through this book. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And, it is awesome. And I'm only at the part like he's gotten his second job writing games at, you know, Soft Disk or whatever. It's awesome. So if you care about this space at all,
he narrates the Audible version. Yeah,
Chapter 12, Destined to Doom. In 1991. Wolfenstein 3D assumed the number one spot.
He's good. That's pretty. He's a good reader. He's doing all right.
Yeah.
He has a very good memory. He talks about this in the beginning of the book. He has one of those, like Richard does, I think, right? Like a kind of a didactic.
Eidetic.
Yeah. So he's like that. So he has a very clear. A lot of the guys that worked at id, like John Carmack, when asked about details of whatever, they always say, go talk to Romero. He remembers.
He remembers.
By the way, I'm learning something else because the copyright is Alfonso Romero. Is that his real name? Alfonso?
Oh, yeah. He's Mexican. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
The whole first part of the book is his terrible childhood. And his family is horrific.
Yeah, he had a terrible. Horrific. I remember that from the Doom book that you recommended.
So I met him. He did the opening keynote at a conference in Switzerland that I did the closing on.
Okay.
And I think we were like the two old guys.
I suspect he had longer hair than you did.
Much longer. And it has now living in Ireland as well.
Yeah. So, I'm pretty sure he's one of the Sheen brothers. And instead of going Estevez, he went Romero.
Alfonso Romero is such a good name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Should have kept it.
But as soon as he was talking about he was promoting his old book and talking about the new book coming when I signed up immediately at the time.
Okay.
And then I said, so how are you going to talk about Daikatana?
Yeah. Which was a massive failure.
It was. Well, and it was one of those things, you know, it's the classic sort of James Cameron, George Lucas, like when nobody can tell you anymore and you're just going to build the great work you always meant to build. Yeah. It happens to everybody.
Nobody says no.
Did you ever play it?
Exactly.
Honestly, I didn't hate it, but the thing I remember, they switched to like the Quake engine, like right at the end or something.
Yeah.
So there were all these like awkward looking shapes, like that were bold. They were kind of off a little bit and flowers and things, but it was okay. There was like that stereotypical black character that ran around with you. And I think a woman as well. And it got weird. Like there was some weird stuff, but.
Well, it's one of those things where because nobody can tell you no, shipping is not required.
Yeah, and it took him years,
he kept pushing it back until the point. That's why the engine change happened. It took so long. It had become irrelevant.
So this guy has a game-making background, I think, would surprise even people who know about all the Doom stuff. So he did Apple II games early in the day, learned the Commodore 64 and all that. So I think that part was very interesting. And I just, not from the book yet, because I haven't read it all, but he also has remained in this industry this whole time. I mean, fair enough, he hasn't had the big blockbuster games, but he's done mobile games. You know, he's in recent years has kind of revisited the Doom stuff. He's made all new Doom, WADs
or whatever. And believe me, he's not got the biggest gaming debacle by any stretch of imagination. Chris Roberts owns the greatest gaming debacle of all time, because it's still ongoing.
Which
Star Citizen.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to read a story, go read what's happened with Star Citizen.
It makes it's never Duke come Nukem out forever right? look
it's yeah. no it's still in beta. It'll right. it's now you're talking a 9-digit number for a product that hasn't shipped. This is a different league.
right
Wow. All
right. Anyhow, this guy's very interesting. This book so far is fantastic. I recommend.
Yeah, and a phenomenal guy. Like, it's a worthy story.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Really.
Doom Guy. Life in First Person by John Romero. The
Doom Guy.
Doom Guy. Well, that concludes your picks, I'm gathering. So it must be time for a Run As Radio plug from Richard Campbell.
This week's show with Corinne Bissett, who I've talked to before in the past. And this was much more of an architectural conversation show, because we were talking about the challenges of sort of contemporary live in the cloud organizations and how all these different SaaS products need to communicate and connect with each other and be secured. And so it was really the challenge of governance around SaaS, with this idea that we have all these sprawling services running in all these different places, and somehow we want single sign on, we want control of authentication, we want control of rights, and it's hard. And so, the right set of products and the oversight to it. How do you know that this piece was being attacked and that piece wasn't, when it's not your stuff? It's all SaaS.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. Corinne's right in the midst of all of that, as a consultant dealing with folks that are battling those problems.
Run As Radio, $889. Available at runasradio.com.
Yep, staring 900 in the face.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And I'm in the mood for a nice whiskey.
One I think you already know and like. The Glenfarclas.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Glenfarclas meaning the Valley of Green Grass, but that's not the fun part of the story. Obviously a Speyside. They're just south of the Craigellachie, one of my favorite places to hang out. One of the oldest distilleries, first opened in 1836. But the real story of it starts in about 1865 when the Grant family buys it. And has been continuously operated by the Grant family ever since. We talk about all these distilleries bought by Diageo and Suntory and Nikkei and so forth. This is the 6 generations of the same family running this distillery.
Wow.
In the mid-1800s, they had a brief partnership with Glenlivet and got into trouble and were able to buy it back and keep it operating. And it was sort of a thing of, we're never doing this again.
Yeah,
and
I see this barrel from 1963 says Glenfarclas Glenlivet.
Glenlivet, right. That's the relationship in the Grant family. So, old school distillery, like through and through. They have the largest stills in the Speyside at 21,000 liters. And those giant stills, by the way, are direct fired.
Wow. So is that what you see in the background there? Is that the
look
picture
at that
in the
thing.
Back?
Yeah.
The giant still.
That's one of the used looks, up ones.
It's a SpaceX rocket.
It's either that or the MSG Sphere. I don't know which.
There you go. Yeah.
Right, wow, exactly. That's big.
So, huge. But so they have, we talked about how in the steam revolution in the late 1800s, they started using boilers to heat the stills because it was miles safer and it also moderated things. But the Grant family decided they liked the flavor of the toasted wash as it's being distilled. And so they still to this day use direct fire.
Wow.
They also do split fermentation, which is unusual. So they actually ferment 2 separate periods, a 70-hour fermentation and a 105-hour fermentation to pull certain flavors from their malt that way. Again, unusual approach to making whiskey, but it's at substantial scale. They typically produce somewhere in the neighborhood of 750,000 to 1 million bottles a year. They use only Dunnage warehouses. So that is wooden racks and dirt floors. And they have a lot of space because they hold 52,000 casks. that last count.
Curiously out of step with the company. It looks like, is it like a Laverne and Shirley font or something? It's very strange. It's weird.
So
it's not Aptos.
It's no Aptos.
They make a few.
I know Aptos. You know Aptos.
Yeah, they do make a few different styles. Sort of their classic line, the age line. They make a 10, a 12, a 15, a 25, a 30, and a 40. They're all barreled exactly the same way. They're aged in sherry casks, 100%. No bourbon involved at all. Bourbon in some of their other additions.
You can see that when they put them all together, the whiskey getting darker and darker.
Absolutely.
As it gets older. It's great.
And they do not use color treating. So it is the natural colors.
That's great. Colors coming from the barrel, right?
That's the barrel. That should be you can't regulate this, but that should be the law.
Well, it's also a consistency thing. Like you want it to be the same color each time when you pick it up, and it's not going to be with Glenfarclas. You are going to see variations and all that. Yeah. I usually recommend the 12 for someone who's dabbling in Farkless, about $65, readily available. And that's a 43% alcohol, again, 100% sherry cask. If you want to spend some money, you can get the 25 and that'll cost you a couple of $100.
Have you tried the family casks?
Well, it's funny you should bring that up because the family class it was originally mocked as a prank, except that they cried all the way to the bank, but they deliberately did these, distillations of casks. They realized at one point that they had casks for going back to 1952. And so they started doing these family caskings. And so you know, literally it's like, why do people buy expensive whiskey? And it's because they want to get something special for someone. So suppose you wanted to get a gift for someone that was
born
in 1956, maybe.
Yeah.
Say you had a friend that was born in 1956. So you can go to Farkless to the family cask collection.
I would do that. The
56 is bottled in 2014. Run you about $7,500.
Oh, never mind. Hey. Holy cow. You can get a bottle of Napoleon for that. That's
he's like co-pilot was expensive.
Yeah, yeah. So,
never mind.
The idea of getting one for someone, and again, that year will be the year it was malted. Doesn't necessarily say how long it's bottled.
Oh, it might
for.
Be all different. Yeah.
Yeah, and typically they are 30 and 40 year old.
I would feel weird drinking $7,500.
That's too expensive.
I'm with you, right? That 56 that I was talking about for $7,500, that's a 57 year old whiskey.
Jeez,
wine, a 57 year old wine may or may not be good. Does whiskey always get better with age?
No.
Ooh. Okay.
So I find the sweet spot when you're not price sensitive, and I'm price sensitive. Let's be clear. Like I'm only going to spend so much on whiskey. I spend more than most people, but I've had opportunities to taste all sorts. I taste 40s. I've tasted 50s. I've tasted 60s. They get very tarry. You're not going to enjoy them. There's the amount of, and the game here is realize they're losing alcohol every year. And if they get below 40%, they can't sell it.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
So they're monitoring these casks. And when they start to get close, when they get below about 46, they're going to bottle it.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to get better from there. And even then it's like, that's a long time. It's just risky. They can go sour. It's challenging.
Not worth it. Yeah.
Not for drinking.
Yeah. Richard, well, that's the thing. If you got this bottle, you wouldn't open it. You'd put it on your
shelf. And aeronize the, and this is the crazy part, right? Like, it's like, what?
Well, you could fill it with brown water. I mean, at that point, you might as well just drink it.
By the way, I still have my Napoleon brandy bottle, which is a beautiful crystal bottle, and it's almost out of brandy. And Dvorak said, just go to Costco and get some brandy and put it in there. No one will know the difference.
Yeah, exactly.
Few people will know the difference, right? I mean, gags when I'm doing a whiskey tasting is I'll drop a brandy in the middle of it just to see if anybody's paying attention. It's not that easy to tell.
That's awesome.
This was really good. But of course, I'm conditioned by the fact that it was thousands of dollars.
And that's where the blind taste tests are so great for that.
Yeah.
You know, and so when I have folks who are really into alcohol of one form or another, we'll do like blind taste testing vodka, rank these by price. You're going to fail. I guarantee you.
Right.
And blind taste testing alcohol aged in wood, it is extremely difficult to tell the difference between that was barley malt aged in wood versus that was grapes aged in wood because the bulk of the flavor comes from the wood.
Yeah, this was right. the Louis the 13th that came in the Baccarat crystal decanter, yeah. And it was beautiful. Nice.
Yeah, I should do it. I'll do a separate piece at one point. I mean, I've been writing a couple of these scripts, but I've been busy moving, so I don't get a lot done. But it's like some of the best cognac I've ever had was made in Transnistria, for crying out loud, right? a breakaway province of Moldova, and it was $40, right? But because it's made in Transnistria, right. But they use the cognac process. You can't call it cognac, right. And all the Russians buy it, so you don't normally ever see it.
Right.
But by golly, I've lost a couple of weekends. It's a very fine brandy that way.
Tell me some good, cheap brandy I can put in my Louis XIII decanter, and you will be a winner.
There you go. Beautiful, yeah. Beautiful piece of glass.
Oh, yeah.
Lovely drink, too. But
in fact, you could sell the glass for hundreds. I mean, it's worth $1,000 by itself.
Yeah, and somebody fills it up with iced tea and lets it cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I probably should put iced tea in it. I still have, there's just a finger left in it. And I don't want
Well, I got to run to Poland in the fall, and that's about as far west as I can get and still have access to Dvin. So I will be coming home with some Kvint and other Transnistrian brandies, because that's one of the hardest things to lay hands on.
It's
a little tricky to go to Moldova right now. I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So, but I'll try and grab it in Poland while I'm there.
Here's a picture of a guy who never probably ever had the Louis the 13th. And believe me, if you're holding a $7,000 bottle of brandy like that, you don't deserve it.
This guy's making music videos where he's showing off his sneakers.
Yeah.
He has nothing to do with this.
Aren't the points on that digging into his hand?
Yeah,
I hope so. Look at him.
You know, I just have learned, though, that there's an NFC chip in the cork stopper. So I'm going to have to scan that so I can join the club.
There you go.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Maybe mine is so old it doesn't have it. I don't know. That sounds like something new. All right. The Glenfarclas I could absolutely agree. Delicious. Don't get 1956.
You'll be very happy with it.
Do not get 1956 for me or anybody else you know. Stick with a 12-year-old.
Yeah. I mean, really, the 12, the 15, and the 20, if you want to spend money, the 25, like, $25 is $200, and I would say it's a $200 experience. Wow. Like, it's legit.
Oh, wow.
Compared to the $65 experience you get for the 12. Oh, wow. You will notice the difference. Oh, they're lovely. Yeah. It's still a lot for a bottle of booze.
It is.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have concluded this edition, this exciting edition of Windows Weekly, the Xbox AI edition. We do Windows Weekly every Wednesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. That would be 1800 UTC. You can watch us do it if you want while we're doing it at live.twit.tv. There's audio and video streams there. Watching live, chat live, and are open to all IRC. You don't only need a browser, although if you have an IRC client, you can use that at irc.twit.tv. Club Twit members, God bless them all, can use the Club Twit Discord. Get behind the velvet rope and enjoy the paid experience. It's kind of like the difference between a 40-year-old Glenfarclas and a 1-year-old Glenfarclas.
If you say so.
I don't know. No, it's not. Actually, they're very similar. But you do have the nice warm feeling that you're supporting what we do here with your $7 a month subscription. You also get no ads in any of the shows. You get shows we don't put out anywhere else, like Paul's Hands-On Windows show. The new AI show is going to be club only initially because the club pays for it, in effect. So if you're not a member, twit.tv/clubtwit to find out more. And thank you in advance. After the fact, all of our shows are available on the website at twit.tv. In this case of Windows Weekly, twit.tv/WW. There's a Windows Weekly YouTube channel. Great way to share clips with friends. You know, hey, did you know about this, 1,300 video games in one package? Oh, here's the clip. And of course, if you listen regularly, you should probably subscribe. Get yourself a podcast player and subscribe to Windows Weekly. That way you'll get it every Wednesday the minute it's available. Paul Theroux is at Theroux.com. That's be a premium member and get all the goodness. Theroux.com. His book, Windows Everywhere, his books, plural, and the Field Guide to Windows 11, both are available at leanpub.com and are really good reads. Well, I wouldn't read the field guide. That's more a reference. Yeah, you could read it. Do people read it, Paul, like cover to cover? Like put it by the bedside table?
Yeah, I hope not. You could.
Read it like he wrote it in spurts.
Right. All over the place. Yeah,
exactly. All over the place.
Go from chapter 1 to 13 back to 7.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Richard Campbell is at runasradio.com. That's where Run As Radio, the podcast, and .NET Rocks live. And he lives in Coquitlam, Canada, in British Columbia. Paul is in Macungie, PA, although these days,
moment today.
These days he's in Mexico City. How long are you going to stay today, or this trip?
Through the 31st.
Okay.
Nice.
All months. Is the weather nice? I guess it doesn't get that hot there, huh?
Honestly, it's been, it's eased up, but this is the rainy season. The last week has been insane for rain. It's been much more than usual. Yeah.
Well, it's been sweltering on the East Coast, so you're glad to be where you are.
Yeah, it's better than back home.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. It's time to be away.
Yeah.
Yep. He's a snowbird.
yeah, basically.
Sorry. So he's a sun, snow, and rain bird.
I'm a summer bird.
Summer bird. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next time on Widows Weekly.
Hey there, I'm Micah Sargent from Twit. And you may be asking a question. What in the world do you do if you want to thank that hard-working team of yours? Well, why not gift them a Club Twit corporate subscription? Oh, and here's a secret. You'll be benefiting yourself, too, because you will be able to keep your team informed and entertained with podcasts covering the latest in tech, so they'll always stay up to date. With a Club Twit subscription, they're going to get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. They'll get access to the members-only Discord server where they can chat with fellow Club Twit members and all of us here at Twit, and exclusive shows like Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit and look for corporate plans for complete details.